Tonight on The Download, Southside Irish Parade honorees, the Martin McGarry family. From the new Magic Lounge in Uptown, Joey Cranford. And we talk with Mike Milosh from the band Rye. Now, here's your host, a man who also owns a Magic Lounge. He can make a whole pizza disappear. Justin Kaufman.
Unfair. But it is a magic trick. It's one that I like to pull out right around 10:30, 11 o'clock at night. Who wants to see this tombstone disappear? I can make it happen. Hey, everybody. Justin Kaufman. It's The Download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin. I just said that. With you till 11 o'clock. Exciting to be here. I'm doing Cochrane tomorrow morning. Did I tell you that, Pete? I don't know if I told you that.
You're working a night.
I know.
Three hours of sleep?
That's what I said. It wasn't until my wife kind of pointed it out. She was like, when are you going to sleep? I'm like, oh, no, there, one's at night and one's in the morning. Like, they're different. I mean, there's a full 8 hours. And I'm like, not eight, set, sick. Well, all right. I'll be there.
Yeah.
It's a pretty quick turnaround because I get in the building around 5:30 in the morning. But I'm excited, though.
It's great to host big show.
No, I love it. I love it. And that crew is so fun. And Steve's back on Friday, so it's nice to get the final show in.
Yeah.
You know.
Big plans?
Yeah. Brent Seabrook, Breakfast with the Blackhawks.
All right. Good old number seven.
Yeah. And Erica Harold, who's running for Attorney General. On the Republican side, will be on the show. So we got some really cool stuff. Sandberg, Mary Sandberg, I call her. It's so funny. Like on the show, she's called Sandberg.
Yeah, yeah,
that's what Cochran calls her. So that's what you have to kind of go by. Nor as Mary, and she does a great job with that show. And she has put together a tremendous show for tomorrow. Yeah. So she actually does a lot of work, Pete. I mean, it's a different, you know, when you're at the level of a Mary Sandberg, you know, she puts the work in.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the nighttime producers and the guys on the 7 to 11, they just slack off. They just they don't do anything. So, all right, we have a huge show lined up tonight. I'm very excited about it. There's always a potential to phone it in. You know, when you have something, you're doing a show the next day, but not tonight. We have a tremendous show lined up. Coming up at 7:30, 80 Quinn's going to join us. We're going to talk about, from the Daily Line, we're going to talk about the assessor's race, what's been going on. It's become our Matt Damon here on The Download, to Jimmy Kimmel's Matt Damon, in the sense that the last three weeks or so, we have tried to talk about the assessor's race, and we continue to run out of time. So we have flipped it this week, and we are going to start with the assessor's race. A lot to talk about, especially today, as more information comes out about the incumbent who has a side job as a lobbyist and some of those companies getting tax breaks from the assessor's office. So we'll talk about that coming up in the 7:30 segment. At 8 o'clock tonight, the Southside Irish Parade is back. 40th anniversary this year. 40th year. How about that? There was a couple in there they missed, though, and that's what I want to find out, because there were 3 years where they shut it down. Like, yeah. They shut it down because it got unruly.
Mm-hmm.
And so now, I guess you count that? I guess because it was in 1978, 1979 is when it started. So you count 40 years to get it, but I don't know if they count those three. The honorary, you know, they have the Grand Marshal, and then they honor somebody. They were honoring Martin McGarry this year from the McGarry Boxing Club on the south side of Chicago and Beverly. They had made that announcement in November, and Martin McGarry died in January. It's a tragic loss for the community. A longtime boxing coach. He had the club and the gym, the McGarry Gym, a well-known and well-respected member of that community. And he was being honored by the parade before his passing. So tonight we'll talk with the McGarry family, two of his children, about the honor and what we can expect from the parade, which is coming up this weekend, Sunday. That's your old stomping ground, right, Pete?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Love that parade.
Yeah, so that parade kicks off on Sunday at noon.
I think it was one of the reasons they perhaps stopped doing it as well.
They did say this. Is Zimmerman going to be there? Is he going to be there tonight? I don't know. We're going to talk a little Magic. The Chicago Magic Lounge opens in Andersonville. We're going to talk Well, actually, this is great. Beth Finke's back. Beth was on last week. Beth teaches a class here in Chicago to seniors about how to tell your story, memoir writing class. She was in last month. Great segment where she brought one of her students with, talked about Regan Burke's life. It was great, right? And another student is in studio tonight. Bob Eisenberg grew up on Maxwell Street. Bob Eisenberg coming up, 82 years old. He'll tell his story tonight on the Tell Your Story segment we put together. Swap Meet tonight with Greg Flamm. I'm already getting some stuff on Twitter, which is awesome. People essentially tweeting stuff. I put in the tweet, if you follow me at Justin Kaufman or WGN Radio, I put in the tweet tonight, I'm giving away a pizza for the best Chicago memorabilia. And it's gaining traction,
yeah.
So I'm getting a lot of Bears stuff tweeted at me. A lot of Bears platters.
Yeah.
Like that. So that's good. So we'll do that coming up in the 10 o'clock hour. And also Milos from the band Rye. Great album just put out. It's going to be at Thalia Hall coming up. Great score to have Milos on the program tonight. So much to do. Man, geez, that's a lot. My head's spinning. News, weather, and traffic tonight. Pamela Jones and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. We'll come back and do the carryout, so stay with us. It's The Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Let's carry out. All right, here are today's top stories. Woo boy! It's less than 2 weeks till the primary. Can you believe it? This election cycle's been so long. I feel nostalgic, right? My primary election's all grown up. We've grown to love these characters, like a real-life Cheers. JB and Bruce, Dan, Chris, Coach. I'm sorry, I'm Pat Quinn. The candidates are getting ready for their last-ditch two-week sprint to the polls today. The news all dominated by pointing out lies in campaign commercials. What? They lie? What? That's by Kristen Wiig. What? Surprise? Not a more boring news out of the White House. Gosh, stories about government and issues with the president. It's such a yawn fest, right? Like this one here. It just says, at the adult film star Stormy Daniels suing the president to be released from a non-disclosure act that she could tell the public her story about having an affair with Trump a decade ago. And that the president's lawyer filed a secret restraining order this week to stop Daniels from talking about it. Ugh. I don't even know how to stay awake for this news anymore. It's so boring. Wake me up when we start talking about tariffs again. Foxconn, the big electronics company that the state of Wisconsin wooed to Racine, is trying to get clearance to pump 7 million gallons of water from Lake Michigan per day to their plant. As Roe was talking about, even though that's a big number to us peons, it's not going to make a dent in the lake, which has trillions and trillions of gallons of water. But that's not the real issue here. The issue is that there's an order of protection to keep companies from wasting precious fresh water. And there's a question whether or not Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker would just waive the order to give Foxconn whatever they desire. What? A local governor can do that? I mean, where does it stop? So in 100 years, when we figure out how to make water, but it makes us all die of cancer, I can't wait for history to judge, right? I'll read that book. I'll read that coffee table book before I die. Cook County Assessor Joe Berrios is running for re-election and has faced a lot of scrutiny because of giving property tax breaks. But this story coming out now takes the cake. Altria, I don't know what they do, but they got a big property tax break from Berrios' office. The rub? Berrios has a side job. No, not like you and me where we pick up work as freelance writers or Little League umpires. Nope. Berrios' side job is being a lobbyist. And guess who hired him? Altria. Maybe the state constitution doesn't specify that politicians shouldn't be paid by private companies to do their bidding in their elected office, but that still doesn't make it right. Right? I don't know much, but I do know that that sounds pretty shady. Maybe it's just me. And Berrios is not the only one that does it. Madigan and a ton of other politicians in the system. Oh, that's something stuck in my throat. A lot stuck in my throat on that one. Geek Squad, the computer technicians at Best Buy. Well, turns out they do look at your history. They've been turning customer data over to the FBI for over a decade. What? I mean, if you can't trust Geek Squad, Who can you trust? It's actually putting FBI informants when it comes to child porn. So I guess that's a good thing. But still. And if you didn't think they were doing it, shame on you, right? Just in weather, a little bit of snow last night, but melted away today. Come on. Let's go, March. 2 weeks away from the official start of spring, which means nothing in 2018, except that we're this much closer to May when spring is now located. In traffic, trains were stopped this morning because of a sick passenger. What does that mean? Like a throw 'em up? Or like an alien kind of thing where they spontaneously combusted and green goo went everywhere and they had to quarantine? Sick passenger can mean a lot of things. Maybe we are becoming this cupcake society. Nobody stopped the trains when I got, quote unquote, sick coming back from a tequila party in college. Right? You do what the respect any respectable person would do. Throw up in your coat, you know, and then run home. In sports, the Bulls got a tanking warning from the NBA. Yep, the league went out of their way to warn the Bulls because they've been resting starters Robin Lopez and Justin Holiday. How embarrassing, Bulls. I mean, we could talk about tanking all day, but it's your job to at least fake it, right? I mean, the 76ers have been tanking for 4 or 5 years now. But you're the ones that get the warning? This is just a ridiculous season for the Bulls. In college basketball, the Lady Blue Demons destroyed Marquette last night to win the Big East tournament down at the new Wintrust Arena by McCormick Place. How about it, huh? Once again, DePaul's women's basketball is on point. They will head to the NCAA tournament now with a wide open field on who will finish second to Connecticut. The men's squad is playing now as well against Marquette. I don't know what the score is on that, but we'll see. Boy, do Bears fans have big appetites right now. As many star caliber players are getting cut and hitting the open market next week. Wide receivers Jarvis Landry and Allen Robinson look to be switching teams, although that can change. And don't sleep on other names, too. Inside linebacker Preston Brown of the Bills, Ravens center Ryan Jensen, or how about Bengals tight end Tyler Eifert? All on the market. I like what I'm hearing here. Also, the Bears put the transition tag on Kyle Fuller, which just means that they won't lose him straight up in free agency. If another team bids on him, they will have the right to match. A week away from all this happening for real. Also, the Bears will sign Matt Forte to a one-day contract next week so he can officially retire as a Bear. That's a good move. I like that. Yu Darvish looked good in limited action yesterday in his debut for the Cubs. Also, Ben Zobrist back on the field with a big beard. Saw that's really unruly. It means absolutely nothing, though, but the Cubs are in first place in the Cactus League. Charlie Tilson, who was once projected to be the center field starter for the White Sox, was optioned, which is a fancy spring training word for cut, hopefully to make way for youngster Luis Robert. I cannot get that kid's name right. He's got the most basic name, Luis Robert. And I'm always like, Louis Robert? Just automatically think it's French? No, it's Luis Robert. The Cuban youngster played his first game this spring, started his first game this spring, and he hit a grand slam in the eighth. No big deal. He's going to be great in 2032. Also, the Sox continue to be referenced in rumors for still free agents Mike Moustakas, Carlos Gonzalez, and Connor Gillespie. So hopefully they sign all of them. Putting Moose behind Abreu in the lineup or Cargo hitting in front of Avi? Huh? I know we're rebuilding, but a fantasy baseball champ can dream, right? Have I mentioned that I'm a fantasy baseball champ? Two-time? Also, all those free agents I mentioned are rep by agent Scott Boras. He also represents Jake Arrieta. Maybe MLB owners aren't colluding against free agents, but instead they're colluding against Scott Boras. You ever think about that? They just don't like the guy. And finally tonight, the Loop WLUP has been sold. The rocker will change formats to contemporary Christian music. The Loop has had a special place in so many Chicago radio listeners' hearts. I can positively say that listening to that radio station as a high school kid turned me on to this profession. But the best part of all of the fond memories is seeing the headshots of former Loop stars, right? Including our very own Bill and Wendy. If you can find it online, it's a treat. Wendy looks amazing with her jean jacket and her big hair. And Bill left. He's not wearing a hat. R.I.P. to the Loop. You did your job. That's the carryout for March 7, 2018. We're 2 weeks away from spring, so we're introducing spring rolls to our menu. They're still frozen. They haven't really thawed out yet. It's a metaphor. All right, coming up, AD Quigg's going to join us from the Daily Line. We'll talk about all the storylines in politics today, including the assessor's race. Coming up at 8 o'clock, we'll talk about the Southside Irish Parade and the legacy of Martin McGarry. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Pamela Jones is in for Rob Martyr tonight. Pamela, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you as well. Nice. Someday we'll meet in person.
I know you're up on the seventh floor, but right. I was a fan of yours when you were here reporting the news out in our beautiful 10 o'clock news studios over at CBS.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm going to have to hook up with you on Twitter.
Yeah. Hey, that's where it's all happening.
All right. I'm a little slow with the social media thing. Like, I'm still hanging on to Facebook.
my Twitter feed is coming up on the download. That's it.
That's awesome.
That's really it.
So. And people have lots of questions, don't they?
Yeah. They've got a lot of questions.
Yeah.
Pretty much. Thanks, Pamela. It's a download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Lots to talk about as we are within 2 weeks of the primary here for the, what do you call it, the state?
Statewide positions.
There you go. That's a mouthful.
Yeah.
AD Quigg in studio. She is, of course, her political reporter with the Daily Line. She joins us every Wednesday to talk about all city, state, and county races. Good to see you, AD.
Thanks for having me.
Not just races, but storylines. Let's start with the assessor's race, only because the last 2 weeks we've bumped it in awesome fact.
Matt Damon of the Download.
We cannot get to the assessor's race, so we're starting with it tonight.
Yes.
This is a race that Cook County assessors, Joe Berrios, who's also the chair of the Cook County Democratic Party.
Yes.
He's also a committeeman here in Chicago. And he has fallen under some scandal because of a big series that the Chicago Tribune ran about how our property taxes are gamed, that the downtown businesses are getting less and residents of Chicago are getting more.
Yes.
And this is under Berrios' watch. And to his credit, he has said, that's what I'm trying to fix.
Well, it's a mix. Yeah. So he said, this has been a problem for 40 years and I've been actively trying to fix it, but also denying a lot of the findings in the Tribune story. So President Preckwinkle and Joe Berrios ordered an independent analysis of the system. It took 7 months to put together. About four of those months were just spent negotiating how to keep a lot of things secret. and when they did get the data, it took them about a week to come up with their initial findings and then another month before they put everything out.
There was some question whether or not it even came out before the primary,
It did. It did. And it basically confirmed what the Tribune said, that high-value homeowners were getting a bigger break and low-value homeowners were taking on more of the burden.
And not to mention, for industrial and downtown stuff. And today,
every dollar that big, high-value properties aren't paying, everyone else is making up.
Great to know.
Yeah.
And that makes a lot of sense as I look at my property tax bill. Today came out another scandal of sorts. The company is called Altria.
Right? Yes. It's a tobacco company.
And they were the benefit of a lower tax or a tax break.
Yes.
And then it was found out that Joe Berrios on his side job, he is a lobbyist, and that they had paid money to him as a lobbyist.
Joe Berrios is not a registered lobbyist. He has a 49% interest stake in a lobbying firm. So he is not a registered lobbyist with the state, but he does own a lobbying company that lobbies the state. And Altria was a client of that.
When this kind of thing comes out, and it's one that I think everybody who's listening to this program and everybody who has half a brain scratches and says, that can't be right.
Yes.
Is there any sort of inspector general? Is there any place that goes, wait, that can't be right?
I believe the County Ethics Board could have something to say about it. What Berrios' office has said is that they have no role in that he took no direct role in deciding what the assessment of this property was, that it was his office. But at the same time, he said, I stand by the assessment.
But this has been an issue, and obviously there has been more of a grassroots groundswell campaign.
Yes.
To take Joe Berrios on in the assessor's office more than ever before. Fritz Kagi is the challenger. He's a progressive Democrat who comes in, doesn't have any electoral experience per se, hasn't held any office. He's self financed his self-funding, he's a millionaire kind of thing.
Yes, let me find you the actual total. So Kagi's campaign has 1.9 million in it right now. 1.5 million came from him.
So he comes in and he says, I can do the job better. He represents the progressive mantle of Chicago politics. Where does he come from? And how do we trust that he's the guy that's going to right the ship, since he has a lot of money and doesn't have any experience?
Right. So I think the reason he was an exciting candidate for some people was that he could self-fund. We're seeing this with... people were afraid to run against Bruce Rauner for the same reason people were like, we can't afford to run against this guy.
Right.
So he is an investment analyst that came from the Columbia Acorn Fund, grew up in Oak Park, says he's been a lifelong progressive and wanted to get involved in this because the system was so unfair. He is a certified assessment officer by the state of Illinois, which is like a brief certification you can take in the state of Illinois. But he was saying, I'm the only person who's actually certified to do this. And he says, I have experience valuing things. My whole career has been spent valuing things and investments, and properties are investments. And I know I can do this job, and I will do it in a more transparent way than Joe Berrios ever has.
Now, the great thing about this is that anyone who is a fan of Chicago and Cook County and even state of Illinois politics is that Joe Berrios is the chair of the Democratic Party in Cook County, not the state. That's Mike Madigan. He has the backing of Mike Madigan. He has the backing of Tony Preckwinkle. Mayor Rahm Emanuel, even to an extent, is, I don't know, he's come out, but he's behind Joe Berrios. All of the major Democrat players in this area,
establishment Democrats,
are backing Joe Berrios. Now the question is that enough in this day in 2018 to say all of these guys get behind? He's got all of the old Chicago machine that's still out there working for him.
Well,
is that enough for him?
The machine isn't what it used to be. We don't have a lot of ward organizations in the traditional way we used to. We got this thing called the Shachtman Decree that said you can't make political hires anymore. And when you can't make political hires at county offices, can't reward people for going out and knocking doors for you. So there are not that many existing ward organizations anymore. President Preckwinkle has a pretty good one. Joe Berrios has a pretty good one. But other than that, the new machine is kind of progressive forces that mobilized behind Bernie Sanders in 2016. And that is who Fritz Kagi has.
And it's a showdown.
Yeah. It's one of the closest county races, and I've had a blast following it. It's been really
Now, there's a wrinkle in this case, which makes this race so interesting, too. There's a third candidate that has been removed from the race, but not from the ballot?
Correct.
Am I getting that right?
So, oh, man, this was so crazy. There were three candidates in the race. All three are on the ballot. Only two are qualified to be on the ballot.
So this was a challenge from Kagi?
From Kagi.
Andrea
Rayla.
Andrea Rayla, and it worked, but it was too late because the ballots have already been printed.
Correct.
And so if you vote for Rayla
It's like not voting at all.
It's like not voting at all.
And every voter that shows up at the polls will get a sheet that says, Andrea Rayla is not a valid candidate. If you vote for her, your vote will not count.
And if anyone does do that, doesn't want to read that, and decides to go for that vote, that ostensibly that helps Joe Berrios because Rayla's running on a progressive style as well.
Yes.
In terms of who
everyone
who would
is
vote
running
for
against Joe Berrios. Yes, so like anything that chips away is in his favor. So a vote for Kagi or Rayla is likely to be a vote against Berrios. So
interesting.
So I think this race could be decided on that margin. From what I've seen, the polling is so close between Berrios and Kagi that if there is, 4 or 5% of voters that vote for Rayla without reading this little sheet, it could go for Berrios.
And the other part of this is the ads that have come out. Joe Berrios' ads against Fritz Kagi, which have been all over the local TV, has nothing to do with the assessor's race. It has to do with gun control and NRA and all the big ticket items that they're just trying to grab on to something to say, and Fritz Kagi took money from the NRA. Can we trust him?
It wasn't even that. It was Fritz Kagi's investment company gave money to a company that donates to the NRA, which was not true. Kagi's campaign said, we came on after this investment and we actively disinvested from this company. And it's distasteful for Joe Berrios to bring up this kind of tragedy after the shooting in Florida.
Of course, but at the same time, it's that's Chicago politics.
Oh, yeah.
But again, gun control, NRA, those kinds of things have nothing to do with the Cook County Assessor's Office. No, so it's kind of funny that
this
that's
is about property values, right. Not gun control.
80 Quig on the Daily Line is in studio tonight. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll continue. Let's talk about Ed Burks, 50 years as an alderman.
50 years as committeeman.
As committeeman. 49. Sorry, I got them switched as committeeman and alderman. And we'll also talk about fact-checking some of these ads. There's another ad that's under review is the ad that we hear constantly that the Rauner campaign put together about Jeannie Ives. So we'll talk about that. 80 Quig in studio. Stay with us. Yeah, stay tuned for that. So also stay tuned for the second half of our conversation now with 80 Quig. She is a political reporter at the Daily Line, covers city, county, and state politics. Tonight we're talking a little mix of both. County is really, it's interesting because the Cook County, all the Cook County commissioners are up. I didn't think about that at all. And are any of those races tight? I mean, because there were, and before we even get to that, remember the soda tax?
Have
we forgotten about the soda tax? I remember when that was going on and the repeal and everything that went into that, there was so much talk from Commissioner Boykin, who we just heard a commercial for, and others that said, I'm going to run for Cook County Board President because Preckwinkle's got to go. And just kind of tapered off. And now she looks like
safe.
She's got Bob Fioretti is running against her, but none of the county people who said they were going to stand up to her actually did.
No, and for a while we thought Richard Boykin was going to run for that seat. But it's kind of hard when the one issue that really fires people up goes away. When they repealed that beverage tax, a lot of that fury kind of dissipated. So I think, I don't know what kind of perfect challenger would have had to emerge that could have taken her down on a separate issue. But the beverage tax is not a thing anymore, and it's very hard to campaign against.
Yeah, that's interesting. Okay, so are there any county commissioner races that are tight, or are those foregone conclusions that the incumbents are going to win?
I'm following three, which I think are interesting. Richard Boykin's race against Brandon Johnson. Mm-hmm. He was a teacher, CTU organizer, has a lot of labor money, and a pretty good message about Boykin cutting from county budget, because he was a big, we need to make cuts before we raise any more taxes. So he's saying we need to protect healthcare, we need to protect our schools. Richard Boykin is a corporate lobbyist, and we need progressive values on the board.
Boykin's pretty popular in his district, and we've had him on talking about issues around violence and issues that are important to the African-American community on the west side. So does Brandon Johnson, is that what you said? Does he have that kind of in to be able to touch on those issues as well?
I'm not sure how well-known he is across the district, but he has a very aggressive mail campaign that's going against Boykin. The Sun-Times and the Tribune have split on their endorsements, citing kind of the exact stuff you were talking about. Boykin is a very loud voice against gun violence and really presses President Preckwinkle on a lot of issues. But Johnson comes at it from this kind of same progressive union angle and building up the county government rather than cutting.
Yeah. What other races are you watching?
Degnan and Fritchie. John Fritchie against Bridget Degnan in the 12th district, which is the city's north side going up to the northwest. That one is pretty tight.
Really?
Fritchie had some health issues that took him away from doing like a lot of the general going to meeting kind of thing where people see your face and
we call that gainering.
people seeing you. She's completely safe.
I didn't realize that a total aside, Maria Pappas used to be the 10th district Cook County Commissioner with Bridget Gaynor is now. So anyway, I digress, but go ahead.
So Fritchie had this health issue, wasn't at a lot of meetings. Some challenged him for kind of the same things on Boykin's side that he wanted to cut from county government when we should be protecting the health system and working on criminal justice reform, and maybe we shouldn't be cutting so much and we should be investing in the good that county government does. She is also has a lot of union backing, a lot of unions who are upset about the beverage tax repeal who had lots of layoffs.
That's interesting that two of the challengers are backed by labor money over some of the Cook County commissioners who are Democrats.
Yeah. A lot of challenges from the left.
All right. So we only have about a minute and a half left, and we can punt the Rauner. Rauner is lying in his ad about Jeannie Ives and
sure.
Madigan.
Pants
no,
on fire.
No brainer. A no duh moment. But the last thing is Ed Burke, 50 years as committeeman, 49 years as alderman. Mm-hmm. What?
Yeah, he's
that's
been
a long time to be an
longest
elected
serving
official.
Alderman in history.
In history.
In Chicago history.
Wow.
Yeah, he started when he was 26.
Does when these kind of stories come out, is he proud? Does he say this is an accomplishment? Does he talk retirement? What happens?
Oh, he would never talk retirement. The only thing that happened was he had an event at the City Club today where he kind of went over his legislative greatest hits and then walked right by the press who had a bunch of questions about his property tax business. And
he's got a lot of conflicts as well.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I was just like, this 50 years have been great. I'll see you all later.
It would be great. I'd love to get him in here. He has had such a sordid, interesting history. As if he's the longest tenured alderman, he was one of the big opponents to Harold Washington.
Right.
Did a lot with the Block 29 and
Verdoliak,
all that.
Yeah, Verdoliak.
I mean, it's just really interesting. And he's been in the news so many different ways, and such an interesting
career.
He's
seen it all, and he knows where all the bodies are buried. If you could get him on here, I would listen to that.
He also, I know this for a fact, this would be the week to get him, or next week, is he is a Irish Chicago historian.
Correct.
That's when you get, as a producer, if any young producers out there, if you're looking to get Alderman Burke to talk, tell him you won't talk politics, and instead you'll just talk about
Irish-American
history.
Irish-South Side history. You will talk about police.
He'll do that,
right.
We'll
talk about Chicago history specifically.
There you go. A.D. Quigg from the Daily Line joins us every Wednesday. A.D., great to see you.
Thanks for having me.
And when it comes to baseball, we have two favorite clubs. The Go-Go White Sox. And whoever plays the Cubs, we're the South Side Irish, as our fathers were before. We come from the Windy City, and we're Irish to the core. From Bridgeport to Beverly, from Midway to South Shore, we're the South Side Irish. Let's sing it out once more.
It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, this Sunday, the St. Patrick's Day festivities get underway, starting at 103rd and Western, ending at 115th. That's right. If you use those street names to paint a mental picture, you know we're talking about the Southside Irish Parade. The parade celebrating its 40th year, although it was canceled for a stretch between 2009 and 2012, as organizers and the community worried about safety because of the rowdy celebrations that were occurring. It was part of the fun. But the family-friendly parade returned in 2012 and hasn't looked back. This year, it's as strong as ever and will feature the Special Olympics as the Grand Marshal, and the Martin McGarry family will be the special honorees. Martin McGarry was a longtime boxing instructor in Beverly. He knew the sport well. As a young man, he won the citywide Golden Gloves tourney, as well as being a state champion. The McGarry Boxing Club was known far and wide for its dedication to kids on the south side of Chicago, teaching them the ropes, literally, to help keep them on the right path. He was so dedicated that he turned his coach house into his gym. Sadly, Martin McGarry passed away in January from a disease called amyloidosis. It's when the body creates too much protein and attacks the organs. McGarry's death was felt not only by his family and his community, but by the boxing world that reached out with memories and condolences. The Southside Irish Parade had already announced in November that they were honoring McGarry for his contributions to the community. And in studio tonight to talk about the honor and about their father is daughter Teresa McGarry Lakowicz and her son and his son Morgan McGarry. Morgan, Teresa, thanks for being here, guys.
Thank you so much for having us.
So this is a great honor, and it's interesting, you know, obviously because your dad was given this honor before he died. You know, I guess my first question for you guys is just, how did he treat this when he was alive back in November when had the opportunity to, with the Southside Irish Parade organizers, to to talk about the parade and announce that he's being honored?
So he always liked the parade. Is always kind of a, you know, you got a big kick out of it. You got a big kick out of, you know, being there and being part of being the honoree. He was real excited to
be a part of it.
Yeah.
He was looking forward to it a great deal. He was very honored and very humbled, and as are we.
Yeah. Yeah, for you guys growing up in the Beverly neighborhood, obviously the Southside Irish Parade, before we get into your story of your dad, the Southside Irish Parade has been a part of your family and a part of that community for, as I said, 40 years. What are your favorite memories? I mean, is it all drunken debauchery, or I mean, is there more that goes into it?
Depends on what side of Western you're on. We grew up on the east side, so we were the family-friendly side. But no, it's so fun. It's kind of like, it's like the beginning of spring, and everyone's out and about, and there's family parties, and there are kind of drunken debauchery.
I think you go on stages as you grow up. Part of it, you know, when you're younger, it's, you know, it's a parade. You know, you catch all the candy and the stuff, and then as you get older, you know, you travel to all your friends' houses who have parties and try to, you know, hit this party, that party, that party, just and then the parade everyone. Is just kind of going on while you're walking around the neighborhood.
Yeah. I mean, it's just a really great community family day. Everyone's together.
What does it mean for you guys to represent your dad, but also your family, honored by this parade? I mean, growing up with it, to be around it, to, as you just mentioned, all the things that, that it means to you and your lives in different stages. What's it mean to be the special honorees this Sunday?
It's really exciting. I mean, our family is so honored and humbled, really, to be able to be the honoree and to help spread the awareness of our dad's disease. To get the message out.
Yeah, very humbling. You know, it's just to be an honor like that, you know, to represent dad is, he'd be super excited about it, you know, so
he'd be proud.
Kind of make him proud and have a good time about it.
Well, the boxing club obviously was known far and wide, and it's something the McGarry Boxing Club and the story that a lot of the local media had told about your coach house in the back and about how that turned into a gym and everyone who came through there. Tell us about it. Tell us about living it, being in the house and knowing dad was in the back and the gym being so close. I mean, talk about memories of growing up with boxing.
So it's kind of a, you know, if you build it, they will come kind of thing, and that's what he would have said. You know, he's said that before. So, you build it, they will come, and sure enough, they did, and kind of took on its own form, and he embraced it, and, you know.
It was his passion. He loved it.
Yeah, it's just a part of him growing up from, you know, Ireland, England, and Scotland, and coming over here and boxing and, you know, sharing his knowledge of, you know, what he's learned, you know, and passing it along to, you know, kids in the neighborhood, kids out of the neighborhood, and all over the place, you know, bringing people to tournaments, bringing, you know.
He was a father figure to so many. I mean, not only kids in the neighborhood, but like Morgan said, kids from all over. A lot of young men that didn't have fathers, he kind of took them under his wing. And for me, I had a different perspective growing up as a daughter. It was like, oh, yeah, all the guys are out in the garage. We had no idea really what was going on, but we just knew there was, like, a ton of guys. If we ever needed, like, you know, something, like a jar opened or something, run out and get one of the guys to do something, you know, like security.
You know, Morgan, being in the presence of your father, and then for all the outpouring that came out after his death in January, the boxing community and all these boxers that came out, I mean, professional level people who worked with or knew your dad. What does that mean? I mean, did that surprise you that, I mean, because you obviously knew about him and what he did, but it was it surprising, all the outpouring after the fact?
In a sense, yeah, but the boxing community is, you know, it is that. It's pretty, you kind of know everyone or know who's who in the boxing community. So to see the people that came out, you know, you see them around anyway, you know, at different boxing events. So it was especially nice to see them come out and, you know,
support
and, you know, give their condolences and stuff. And so it's always nice to see all those people in the first place. But then you see them there and, you know, that means a lot for that, too. So it was nice to see all them people there, and very humbling that all those people you came out to see, you know, you're shaking hands and all of a sudden you look up and it's like, oh man, look at all these people.
And it was a testament for sure to his life and, you know, his legacy. And I mean, the church was packed. It was nice.
Well, true testament though, for sure, you know.
My question really, I mean, as kids in that environment, having the coach house, you know, renovated into a gym, how did you feel about that when it happened? Were you like, what are we doing here? Or were you like, this is really great that dad's going to be home? Actually. Like,
I don't even think we really, it was just kind of part of our life.
Just the way it was.
We didn't, it was maybe 1994, maybe when the garage was built. So we were teenagers, and it was like, okay, dad's building this garage, two-story garage gym.
You got no excuse to not be in shape now at this point. It's right in your backyard.
Yeah. So we had to, you know.
Did he approach the training or any of the boxing with you, Morgan, differently than he did the other kids? Was it a tougher scenario to be in the gym with dad?
He never pushed me at all, actually. I feel like I wanted to be in more, you know, he probably held back with me, but he coached me just the same as, you know, anybody else, really. You know, he never pushed anybody to, like, you have to do this, you have to do it. If you want to do it, you're going to do it, you know, and if you, he'll tell you, you got to work hard, you know, and that was one of the things he always said. You got to work hard for anything you have, and especially in this, because you're not fooling anyone but yourself when you get into the ring.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, let's do this. We'll take a quick break, and we'll come back and talk about other lessons you've learned through boxing, but also through your dad, Martin McGarry, the McGarry Boxing Club, well known in the city of Chicago and all around the world when it comes to boxing. The Martin McGarry family will be the special honorees at the Southside Irish Parade, which is coming up this Sunday, in honor of their father who died of amyloidosis, right?
Yeah, he had familial amyloidosis.
Okay, we'll talk about the disease as well, which is a part of the Southside Irish Parade, and honoring it with the Special Olympics as well, coming up here on Sunday. Both in studio tonight, Teresa McGarry-Lakowicz and Morgan McGarry will continue the conversation. Stay with us. It's a download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. This Sunday, the Southside Irish Parade is back. At 103rd and Western, kicking off at noon. The Grand Marshal will be the Special Olympics, and the special honorees will be the Martin McGarry family. In studio tonight, daughter Teresa McGarry-Lakowicz and son Morgan McGarry. Martin McGarry passed away in January from the disease called amyloidosis, which is I went to the site and I watched the video and everything about it, and the best way to describe it is the body produces too much protein and it ends up attacking the organs.
Right, right. He had familial amyloidosis, and it's really rare. It's a genetic disease. Only 10,000 people worldwide have it. So, of course.
Are diagnosed.
Yeah, are diagnosed.
Really?
Yeah. And it's a hard one to diagnose, because a lot of times it's thought to be something else because it's so rare. Our uncle, my dad's older brother who had it, my Uncle John, he went for a few years without even, he went all kinds of different hospitals and nobody could figure it out until Mayo Clinic was able to diagnose him. But yeah, so.
Do you guys worry about it being a genetic disease in the family? Is that something, as you consider, you know, your futures and your family's futures, about making sure that there's more awareness about the disease?
It's kind of always lingering, like, oh, I've got a 50-50 chance of having it, but
I think it's a personal thing too.
Personal decision.
You know, she might feel different than I might feel, but at the same time, I think my dad brought a big, when he got it, he kind of knew, you know, once he felt the first symptoms, he's like, I think I got it, you know, so, right. He's like, oh, we're going to fight it though. So he brought the fight to it, and,
part of the fight was just bringing awareness.
Bringing awareness is a big part of it.
Spreading it that, you know, get diagnosed early, and the early detection is key, and hopefully.
Because your dad was young. I mean, he was in his mid 60s, right?
66.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, as the Southside Irish Parade kicks off and you guys are the special honorees, it brings you back to the idea of community, because your dad really was a pillar of community. And so many stories have come out from the funeral and from obituaries and everything in between. But it really, again, puts this emphasis on community. You both of you and your families live nearby from where you grew up in Beverly. You're a part of the Southside Irish Parade, which you have been a part of since you were kids. What does it mean to have your dad associated with the community and to be in this position where, you know, his legacy will be always associated with Beverly?
He loved being a part of Southside and Beverly. I think someone came up, brought a sweatshirt out and it said, you know, County Beverly on it.
Yeah, they gave him a sweatshirt. That was years ago. He loved that.
He wore that thing with pride.
I get a kick out of the fact that he came from a town in Ireland, or not even a town, a village of maybe 10 or 11 houses. And even at the wake, I kept looking at like our family, like, who would have thought this man who came from so little would have touched so many lives and had such an impact on so many. So it was great.
I mean, it's always tough. I mean, you guys are obviously being honored, the family's being honored, and your other siblings and the rest of your family as well. But I mean, is it hard to be on the radio right now, to be the front and center on the parade coming up here to talk about your dad, since he passed away in January?
Yeah,
I mean,
it's only been about 6 weeks. It's pretty surreal still, I think.
I think you think of how he would have liked it, and he would have got the biggest kick out of the thing.
Yeah.
So you kind of play it from that aspect and you know, try to forget about the way you feel, you know, and just kind of go with the flow at this point and say, yeah, Dad would have loved to, he would have, you know.
He'll be with us in spirit for sure. I mean, and that was the other thing too. His house and my mom and dad's house was, you know, always full of people. So I think just being around so many people will help us really.
And what's missing in your family? I mean, obviously with your dad passing away, what did he bring to the family? And, you know, what are, you know, as grown children, you know, what is missing at the McGarry household with your family?
He had a good sense of humor, you know, and he always crack a joke here and there. And
he was a jokester. He always had some quick wit, some, you know, remark about something.
I might tell you what he'd say before thinking about it. And, you know, pretty raw.
As every good dad does, right?
Yeah. He was honest.
Wait a second.
We'll miss his charm and his smile. I mean, he had a great smile. His wink, you know, even the last few days, we'd say, "Hey, Dad, give us a wink," and he'd look up and wink at us, and you know, we'll miss that for sure. You know, but
you always kind of miss, like, even the last few years. Really, you missed the way he was, you know, and just kind of dealing, you know, helping him away since he digressed. You know, you just kind of are thinking about, he's getting worse, you know, so how are you supposed to deal with it? But you try to remember the way he was before, you know, before he got sick. So I think that would be
the best part. You know, your dad was, as we talked about, being the head of the McGarry Boxing Club and everything that he brought to all the different kids in the south side of Chicago and all the different people who of course, came through the club. But a lot of it is, and you read about it, it's just about the lessons and advice and the way that, you know, you live your life. What lessons do you take away from your dad?
He just loved life so much. And the message or the legacy that I think he leaves is just live your best life. You know, he came from nothing. He made an impact, and he was positive. He was charming, and he was genuinely a good person and cared, you know, for the best in people and thought the best in people. He was, sometimes we're like, is he just naive, or is he just really that, you know?
I think sometimes he was naive.
Yeah, maybe, sometimes. You know. But anyhow, I think that's it. Just, you know, appreciate everything you have. I mean, because in an instant, it can be gone.
Yes, Morgan. Like you said, he was just truly good-natured, you know, and then he would just try to teach you everything he knew, you know, especially, you know, hey, you're going to work for what you get, and you work hard for it, you know, that's what you
work,
you
know, ethic,
it'll,
for
it'll,
sure.
It'll pan commitment. Out, you know. I think that Teresa pretty much summed a lot of that up there. He always kind of, one of the songs, like, growing up, he liked was "Don't Worry, Be Happy," so he'd play that one on repeat all the time. So don't worry.
Oh my God.
And then he'd, like, something happy. He's like, "Don't worry." He'd
be happy.
Out the word.
Be happy. It was like his motto.
The Martin McGarry family will be the special honorees at the Southside Irish Parade this Sunday. The Southside Irish Parade turns 40. It'll start at 103rd and Western in Beverly at 12 noon. It'll end at 115th and Western. In studio tonight, Teresa McGarry Lakowicz and Morgan McGarry, two of Martin McGarry's children. Martin McGarry passed away in January from a disease called amyloidosis. And this is also a bit of an awareness campaign, because amyloidosis will be on display as well.
Yes.
At the parade.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, if you don't mind, to plug the amyloidosissupport.org website is where you can get information. It's the amyloidosis support group that has helped us and has been so great in getting awareness to us and all the knowledge and information that we have. And Muriel Finkel heads the amyloidosis support group, and she's just been amazing. So, So thank you.
Teresa, Morgan, I can't thank you guys enough for coming in and talking about
the
parade, your family, and your dad. Appreciate it.
Thank
so
you for
grateful,
having us.
And thank
very
you
humbled
so much,
to be a part of everything. So
appreciate it.
Thanks for everything.
Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, tomorrow, Thalia Hall in Pilsen will be the place to be as Chicago welcomes the soulful electronic sounds of Rye.
I'm a fool for that shake in your thumbs. I'm a fool for that sound in your slums. I'm a fool for your belly.
I'm a fool for your love. I wanna make this play. Oh, I know you're faded. But stay, don't close your hands. I wanna make this play. Oh, I know you're faded. But stay, don't close your hands. Caught in this pool, held in your arms. Like a fool without a love. We're in a natural spring with this gentle sting between us. I wanna make this play. Oh, I know you're faded. But stay, don't close your hands. I wanna make this play.
Rye is the project of Canadian musician Milosh. Milosh just put out the record Blood last month. It's getting great reviews. Rye was once the project of Milosh and Denmark's Robin Hannibal, but Hannibal left, and a new iteration of Rye has Milosh getting out of the studio and creating more than just a project, but a full-fledged band with well-respected musicians. Rye's music is stunning. The soprano lends a soulful touch to a hybrid of sounds of R&B and electronica. It may fit into the electronic genre, but it resists the overproduced hectic pace that is synonymous with modern dance music. Blood is Rye's second album, and like I said earlier, they'll be on stage at Thalia Hall tomorrow. But first, Milosh joins me tonight on The Download. Milosh, thanks for being here. We appreciate it.
Thanks, man. How you doing?
Good, good. Thanks for being here. It's amazing how many shows you've done in the last 4 or 5 years touring around. Talk about your experience with Chicago. You're coming to Thalia Hall, but I would assume of the hundreds and hundreds of shows that you've done in the last 5 years, Chicago has played a role.
Yeah, I mean, very early on, we played, I think, it was called Shubas, like, originally, mm-hmm. and then moved to bigger rooms. And it's kind of an interesting thing, because Chicago is also the place where I did my third Milosh record. I mixed it here, and I got to spend a month here and kind of become a little bit familiar with the city a bit. And it's just kind of, it's one of those markers that when we get to play Chicago, it feels like everything's moving really nice. You know, it's not an auxiliary city that's just like a random pick-me-up. It's definitely like, okay, we're properly touring if we can get to play Chicago.
Yeah, and I would assume that having spent time here actually professionally working on music, that it means something to come back, and it hypes you up to come back and perform here.
Yeah, just over the last 10 years, I get to keep kind of having these musical experiences with it. And the only times I've ever been in Chicago has been in the context of either performing or mixing records. So it's just, my whole association with Chicago is just me getting to be musical.
I mentioned the tour and the fact that you've performed hundreds of shows in the last 5 years to really finance and get yourself out of the major label studio deal that you had, but also to finance this record. Talk about what it means to you to be a road musician, to get to a place, to get yourself to finance a project. What's it mean for you to be on the road constantly?
Well, number one, I personally like traveling a lot. I enjoy it. It's not for everybody, but I personally do really like it. And if you do like it, it's a very rewarding kind of situation, because you're getting to do something that you feel, I don't know, really connected to. Playing live, there's a direct association with the money you can generate and then funding a record. I mean, I don't really know a business model outside of that where you can play shows, and that gives you one experience with understanding feedback from a crowd and understanding how people are reacting to the music you're making, and then be able to make a record as a result in the studio, which is a completely different version of making music. You know, you're mm-hmm. by yourself or with two people in a studio. It's very solitary, you know. And then you get to come back onto these stages, which have a lot of people witnessing you. So there's like this kind of yin and yang to it. It's really, it's necessary too, you know. It's the way that you can actually plan out finances for a year and sustain things, because you're booking shows out 6 months and stuff like that. So you can kind of plan making videos in and around that, and financing those as well. But now I'm back with the label. So
the new album, Blood, is amazing. And Woman, which was the album that you did back in 2013 with Rye. With the touring in between and everything that you've gone through in the 5 years of what we just heard from you in the yin and the yang, talk about the evolution of the music. From Woman to Blood, what has changed in your eyes and Milos' eyes when it comes to the music of Rye?
I mean, the biggest thing is that the first record, Woman, was essentially a bedroom project that was done on laptops with a lot of software, synthesizers, and, you know, obviously there were strings and harp and brass and stuff, but it still felt like a laptop record. This record, I really wanted the sound of the live show and the studio record to have a type of marriage where when you see us live, sonically, it makes sense. It's the same instruments. It's the Hammond B3, it's the violin, the cello, the guitar, bass and drums. I wanted them to not feel like what I felt with on the Woman record, which was I was translating like a bedroom project to the stage. This feels like I was writing it so that I could perform it on the stage. I mean, all the live drums on the record are easy to do live because you're doing the same thing. Where the Woman record, it's like, okay, how do we translate these program drums and these electronic drums? How does that change the set? And I've always felt like, okay, the sound is very different live than the Woman record, just because I didn't want to play with backing tracks and I didn't want to use like any software on stage. So personally, it's a very rewarding feeling to be able to accomplish the same thing at night that I did in a studio environment.
There's something great about the pace of the music, and I'm trying to put my finger on it today, but the, you know, a lot of the sounds that you use they're almost slowed down electronic music in this way that if you raise the tempo or brought the pace up, it'd be very familiar to a lot of people who are into techno or that kind of music. Do you have to resist the urge? Talk about your relationship with pace, because there's something amazing about using the sounds and producing the sounds and the instrumentation that you use, but at the pace that you're using it?
I mean, it's a really interesting question, pace. I think, number one, I'm on a bit of a slower pace than everybody else, like on the planet, in terms of it's taking me longer to put out projects. And, you know, it's not like I'm this 22-year-old kid. I've been making records for a long time, and I've had a very natural, very organic curve to my musical career. It's been on a much slower pace. So if I was the kind of person that needed like an immediate return from it, I don't think I'd be able to sustain what I'm doing musically. And everything for me just feels like there's a natural, not a roadblock, but just a slowdown, you know? Everything happens, like even putting out this record took me 4 or 5 years between the records, not because I wanted to, but because there was natural obstacles. I had to buy out the option for the second record and all these things. And it just, everything I do is a little bit slower paced. Also, as an individual, I think I'm a little bit, I don't know, I'm not particularly anxious or intense, I think. And as a result, the music seems to be a reflection of almost the pace that my internal systems kind of run on. I'm fairly patient as an individual as well. Like when stressful things happen, I don't freak out. I don't get too reactive. I try to take things out at a slower pace. And I guess what happens is, the music is truly a representation of probably the pace that I'm on in life. You know?
As any true artist, how you are in your personal life is a lot of how you produce. Milos is my guest. The Project Rye is at Thalia Hall in Pilsen tomorrow night. The album is called Blood. It's out now. It's great. You know, collaboration. You talked about the yin and the yang. You talked about getting in studio and even, you know, the difference between what you do on stage with the band and what you do in studio. How important is collaboration to you? How important is it to work with other musicians to find the right tone to move forward with your music? Over the years, obviously, there's been a lot made of your collaboration with Robin, but just collaboration in general, how important is that to you and your music?
Well, I have two perspectives on it. I mean, I've done Milos records where it's completely me by myself and no one's collaborating and very solitary. When you collaborate with someone, you kind of are a different version of yourself with everyone that you work with. It's kind of like in life, you know. I don't act exactly the same with my parents as I do some of my childhood friends, you know. You've got different chemistry with different people. As a result, you get to kind of really hone in on different aspects of your own personality that come out musically, you know. Thomas Bartlett on this record really brings out like a really sensitive side of me. when I do songs like Count to Five with Itai Shapir, it's like we connect on a more almost like danceable, almost disco kind of vibe. And so that kind of becomes the thing that, that happens. And I think that's what's going on with the Rye Project now. I'm viewing it as an entity where I get to collaborate with different people for different reasons. And, you know, some of the songs I've done completely on my own and other songs are different collaborations. And I want to kind of carry that through the next record I do with Rye, where I work with different people. So I'm constantly being challenged by people, and everyone has a different methodology in the studio and the way that they work. And it's really cool to see that. And I never want to become a person that's stuck in my ways or overly dogmatic about how I work. So it's really, I don't know, it's just really beneficial to work with different people and make sure you're never just getting stuck in your ways. Yeah. Confined to your own little box, you know?
Milos, like I said, is and the Rye Project will be on stage tomorrow night at Thalia Hall in Pilsen. The album is called Blood. Milos, a huge pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much for taking some time out to talk to us tonight. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Have a beautiful day. I appreciate it.
I'm not awake. I'm not alone. You're right beside my face. Will you love me this way? 'Cause I'm dancing with my eyes closed. It's okay, it's me, babe. One more time for my taste. One more time for my taste. See me fall from your eyes to your waist. One more time for my taste. Drink this wine from your sweet, from your case. I feel your love, I feel your faithful ways. You're not awake.
Sounds good. You know what else is coming up at 9 o'clock? I should do this. This is a plug for my extended family. Pete, are you familiar with the show House Hunters?
Heck yeah.
My Pamela, do you watch that show, The House Hunters?
Yes, with much jealousy.
My cousin, Chris, is a realtor in Tampa, right? It's kind of a profession he's picked up in the last year or so. He is going to be on House Hunters tonight. He's the realtor.
Wow.
Wow, that's amazing.
I don't know. That's all I got. I'm probably in the Tampa area. Yeah. So I'm DVRing it.
Wow. Single?
Yeah,
I caught you off guard. I know.
I was going to say, Pamela. Yeah. I don't want to throw the family under the bus. But yes,
always be looking.
Maybe he's not, though. You know, I got to get closer with Chris. I haven't seen Chris in a while. He's out in Florida.
Me too. No, I'm joking.
Yeah, right.
Totally joking.
I feel like Facebook, I can never tell what's going on with my extended family, my cousins, with their relationships via Facebook.
Yeah, I keep mine nebulous.
Yeah, and I feel like I know there's one time there was a girlfriend, and there is, and there's not, and mm-hmm. nobody tells me anything. So I don't know. My other single relative, my Uncle Mike, he was just in the newspaper for he was in the Tampa newspaper because he had gone on stage and paid the money to get a autograph from Stormy Daniels at the local strip club.
No.
Yeah, she comes through and, you know, she's just doing like book signings or whatever she's doing now, and you get to pay to do it. And he went up there and he told her a joke and she laughed and they took the picture and it was like sent around to the family like, hey, Uncle Mike made it up on stage.
Oh, man.
So, yeah. I the best part about it is I probably know the joke. It's probably some cowboy joke. He's big in the, he's a very talented guy. He's like in the Tampa rodeo. Like, yeah, and I could talk an hour about my family in Tampa, but he does like a lot of horse tricks and stuff like that. Like, and he also gets it's like kind of like a Roy Rogers kind of thing.
Hmm.
And then he gets off and he tells jokes, like cowboy jokes. And whenever I see him, because he knows I got a background in comedy, that's the first he beelines to me and does the. Hey, did you hear the one about, he works out the material. And I'm just like, all right, I don't need any cowboy material. I don't know what you're doing. But Stormy loved it. She loved it. So, all right. More to come here in the 9 o'clock hour. I will vouch for that clicker. I'm gonna go tomorrow to Art and to everybody.
Don't do that.
And I'll just be like, Pamela deserves better.
Just sweep it under the rug.
That clicker. No, I'm gonna make a big deal about it. I'm gonna send an all staff.
I don't even know the terminology for this mouse. Like, all I could think of was clicker. It's not a clicker. It's a mouse. It just goes click.
Make a big...
She actually had to walk up to the screen and switch a knob.
Right? Yeah, she's switching knob. Yeah.
I know. You know, I've got a TV that still does that.
Do you really?
Yes, I do.
Great.
Yes.
All right. I like that. All right. Well, you know what? We do a segment coming up in 10 o'clock hour called Swap Meet with Greg Flam, where we will evaluate your collectibles and your memorabilia. So that sounds like something you could probably, Greg could look up and be like, well, that TV is worth something because
it's worth
so
nothing like everything else I have.
No, but if you hold on to it for like 10 more years, maybe
like, you know, my truck,
like your truck,
my
there
truck,
goes.
1999 Nissan Pathfinder.
There you go.
All it's right. Going to be vintage someday.
I'm loving the vintage Pamela Jones.
I am totally retro vintage right. Everything. All I even right. Live in a mid-century modern. How's that?
How about it? All right. We're learning every news break. We learn something new about Pamela. So that's going to be great. All right. So download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up a little bit later, we're going to talk about Chicago's new Magic Lounge in Andersonville, 5050 North Clark Street. This is interesting, the history of this. And I'm looking forward to talking to Joey about it. But there really hasn't been a... Chicago has a great history with Magic, really does. But a lot of the history has revolved around either clubs, nightclubs, or restaurants, or bars having Magic Night, or having a magician on stage. But there really hasn't been a Magic Theater, a theater that is designated for Magic and Magic alone, and that's where Joey comes in. So we'll talk about Chicago Magic Lounge coming up at 9:30, and Greg Flam joins us at 10 o'clock. Well, it's time now for another installment of our new feature, Tell Your Own Story. Author and journalist Beth Finke teaches a memoir class, she still teaches it, a writing class to seniors through the city. She's been doing it for years. The goal is to get her students comfortable in writing down their life experience, their story. Last month, we met Regan Burke, who had just finished her memoir. And tonight, Beth is back with another student, 81-year-old Bob Eisenberg. Bob grew up hustling in the Maxwell Street neighborhood, and he still makes his living cutting and styling hair. He is in studio tonight. Bob, nice to meet you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Beth also has an event coming up on March 15th. It's a talk she's given called Blind in the City, Not as Dark as It Sounds. Beth, of course, is blind and has written about it in her own memoir, as well as the book Writing Out Loud, What a Blind Teacher Learned from Leading a Memoir Class for Seniors. Beth, great to see you.
Oh, nice to be here.
Thanks for being here. All right. So again, why don't we just set, before we get into Bob's story,
okay.
You teach this class. It's really about getting seniors to open up and tell their story in the form of their memoir.
Right.
Where does it come from?
Where was my teaching the class come from?
Yeah, give us a backstory on the class.
I wrote a memoir that I was lucky enough to get published in 2003 called Long Time No See, and it was about losing my sight and figuring out how to go on from there. I was promoting the book, and Joyce Gallagher, the commissioner of the Department on Aging for Richard Daley at the time, was in the audience. Heard me give my presentation and called me and met up with me and asked if I'd want to lead a memoir writing class for the city. And I said no, because I didn't know how to teach. I didn't know anything about that. It's kind of crazy because I was looking for work. And when I think back to that now, I think I've really come a long way because I really did not think I'd be able to teach this. But
well, obviously, with the book that you've written and also the continuation of the class, one of the things I remember from the last segment we talked about this last month with Regan, I love the fact that because you are blind, the students read their writing.
Yes.
Because that's a big part of it. So it's one thing to learn how to write your story and maybe put things down that you didn't think were going to be interesting or might be personal. But in your class, they have to stand up. They have to read their words.
Yes.
And how does that change the feel and what is being taught in the class?
Oh, that's a good question. It wasn't a plan. I didn't think, oh, this is, you know.
No, of course.
That's how you have to communicate, right?
Yeah, right.
So, but how it's changed it is you really feel like you're telling your story and you're getting a reaction when you're reading it. If you've wrote something funny, they'll laugh. Or if there's something kind of shocking, there'll be a gasp. They get an instant reaction. And so they really have an audience. I have learned Well, one time I gave the topic, what are you afraid of? And a woman in the class was afraid of public speaking. And so when she was done, I looked at her and said, so this is really hard for you.
Right.
And she said, yeah, it really is. And so I'd kind of feel a little selfish that I'm forcing these people. But there she was coming to class every week.
Well, let's bring Bob in. Bob, why'd you take the class in the first place? What was it about telling your story that attracted you to Beth's class?
Well, it's interesting to me because I have never written anything before Beth's class. And the memoir writing is something that I absolutely love. And I can tell you that it all started with me in first grade. I had a first grade teacher that wrote the cursive writing on the blackboard, and she asked us to copy the writing. I started doing it. She walked up behind me, reached over my shoulder, took the pencil out of my left hand, walked around in front of me, faced me, put the pencil right at my nose, and said, you're writing with the wrong hand.
Wow. Forced you to write right-handed, even though
forced
you were left-handed.
Forced me to write right-handed. Well, this was first grade, but it blew everything that I wanted to learn about writing. I never wrote.
Because I would assume it's hard, right? It became hard for you. This is too much work.
I would wait for the teacher to walk away, and when I knew she wasn't looking, I would switch the pencil over to my left hand and start writing with my left hand again, and she would catch me all the time, and it just ruined me for writing. I never wrote in any of my academics in grade school from that point on. And so I had a thing against academics and against writing. I never wrote anything until I was 78 years old.
I love it.
And then went to Beth's class and started writing. And, you know, the interesting thing was that Beth only allows you to write 500 words. Well, for me, 500 words was writing a book. But the 500 words are just the right amount. And I never wrote more than that, and I could tell a whole story in those 500
words.
Well,
let's do this. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back, and Bob Eisenberg, we'll get into your story growing up on Maxwell Street. We'll talk a little bit about your time in Chicago and what you do for a living. It's our segment, Tell Your Own Story, with Beth Finke and her students. Tonight, 81-year-old Bob Eisenberg is going to tell his story. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back, and we'll get his truncated story. 81 years, but we'll dedicate a couple minutes to it. It's a download. Stay with us. Thank you, Pamela. It's Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. Beth Finke in studio for our weekly. We should make it weekly. I said it last time. I said, let's make it monthly. Now I'm like, let's make it weekly. Let's make it daily. How many students do you have? This segment is called Tell Your Own Story. Beth teaches a class for seniors through the city on how to write their story, their memoir. In studio tonight, Bob Eisenberg, who is one of Beth's students. He's 81 years old, grew up in the Maxwell Street neighborhood. Now, a lot of young people who might be listening right now is like, oh, yeah, they got a great bookstore and bar and Mexican restaurant down there. But Maxwell Street, when you were growing up in that neighborhood, tell us a little bit about it.
Well, it was the Jane Addams housing projects in those days. And that was the big thing in that neighborhood. But my grandparents moved into that neighborhood in 1917.
Wow.
They had a cold water apartment, which I lived in when I was 11 years old, and with a cold stove in the kitchen. The bathroom had the claw leg bathtub, and we used to heat up, my grandmother and I would heat up the hot water on the cold stove in the kitchen. and carry a big bucket of hot water, both of us together, into the bathroom, pour it into the claw leg bathtub, and that's how she would take a bath on Friday night before the Friday night service that she was an Orthodox Jew.
Was Maxwell Street, as we watch documentaries or even the fictional, the Blues Brothers, things like that about Maxwell Street, is it do you remember it the same way as the full open market and the kind of bartering and trading and everything that was happening down there?
Absolutely. I worked for Sal's in the basement on Maxwell and Halsted, where I would stop people as they walked by and try to get them down to Sal's to buy a pair of pants or a shirt or a jacket, and I would get a commission on
anyone who walked in or bought. Yeah,
yeah. So I loved that neighborhood. I was actually bar mitzvahed on Maxwell and Halsted. There was an old Orthodox synagogue there where I had my bar mitzvah, and that neighborhood was the best. I had a neighbor that lived next door to me. I lived at 1331 Roosevelt Road, and my neighbor, Reuben Dunn, was a peddler, and he had a horse and wagon at Mush's Barn.
You're making that up.
On Grenshaw and Troop. And he asked me one day while I was on my way to school, he said, "Bobby, it's really busy this time of year. The summer's coming and I'm selling watermelons. Do you mind working for me on the weekends?" I said, "I absolutely love it." And we would go on his horse and wagon into the South Water Market, pick up the watermelons, put them in the back of his wagon, and we'd go down the alleys around the neighborhood. And I was the one that sat in the back of the wagon. And as we went down the alleys, I would yell out, "Hold me low.
What?
Milo?" And that was watermelon.
So that was your Italian.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I loved it. I mean, I probably made $4 to $6 a day, but
it was 20 cents a watermelon, right?
Yeah, something like that.
And South Water Market, isn't that right down here, Justin?
Right down here on Michigan Avenue.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So.
So That was one of my jobs, and in the fall, we pick up junk in the alleys, and we go down the same alley. The people, of course, knew us, and what I'd yell in the back of the wagon was, "Rags of Lion. Rags of Lion."
Do you know what he's saying,
no,
Justin?
No, it's Rags of Lion.
Rags and old iron. And people would come down from their porches with their old furniture.
With old rags
old rags.
Stuff they want to get rid of.
Yeah.
They want to get rid of it. And we'd pile it up in the wagon and take it to the junkyard and sell it.
Beth, how, and I feel like, I really could dedicate a whole show to this. I really could do 4 hours. Every time you come in here, it's only the second time, I'm like, the time runs out. And I'm just like,
out.
I'm so mad because I want to do 3 hours with Bob to learn more. And we will. I'm going to figure out a way to do this. But Beth, I mean, that story and the way that you tell it, Bob, and the way that you've connected to your childhood. Beth, is that what you're trying to do when you try to draw these stories out of your students, to say you have a story to tell? Even that story, which you may at one point, Bob, said, there's not really anything there to tell, is great.
Absolutely. Yeah, you've got it. That's exactly what I'm trying to do. And I give a prompt that he wrote that story. Well, he was just saying it now, but I think he wrote it for the prompt of "The Best Job I Ever Had." So the class, somebody might write about a job they had when they were 40, and someone else might write about one when they had 20, you know, whatever. And so it goes around the class that way, and with each person reading out loud, you get to learn about each person that way. And they, you know, you can, Bob's a good storyteller, but and Bob's really good at dialogue, and so he can have Reuben Dunn talking to him and stopping him. And I think it's part of growing up in that neighborhood. Yeah. There was a lot of good conversation going on.
We'll end it there, but Bob, I want to have you back. Maybe as we continue this, you know, we can have you back and we can do a different chapter of your life. You know, it doesn't always, you know, to go in chronological order necessarily.
Yeah, I have a. I have a website, too, that I'm putting my stories on.
Okay, what's the website?
Blissbob.com.
Blissbob.com. That sounds good.
Yeah. Bliss was the name of his salon. Next chapter. Bob became a hairstylist as an adult, so he had his own salon.
Trust me, there's a lot in there, and your friendship with Vidal Sassoon, Vidal Sassoon. But again, I get mad. That's why I'm going to get mad now. Because I feel like we could dedicate 3 more hours to this. Bob Eisenberg is a student who's writing his memoir, but also you can find out all of the stories at blissbob.com. Of course, Beth Finke in studio. She is the author of Writing Out Loud, What a Blind Teacher Learned from Leading a Memoir Class for Seniors. And this segment, we need a good catchy title, but I like Tell Your Own Story.
I do like
For now, I guess it works. Beth, Bob. Bob, great to meet you. Beth, great to see you.
Thanks, Justin. Thanks for having us.
How fun was that, Pete? Huh? I'm telling you, I get so when we run out of time, and I don't know, we feel like I could have done 3 more Bob Eisenberg stories there. But a great story about growing up on Maxwell Street, so we'll have Bob back. And I love that segment. We got to do it more. We could probably do it once a week at this point. Anyway. It's Download 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman here, coming up at the 10 o'clock hour. Greg Flamm is here for the swap meet. He's got a guest tonight, too. We're going to talk about denim. Yeah, I know. Pete's face lit up. He loves the denim. That's coming up at 10 o'clock in the swap meet. Well, the new Chicago Magic Lounge is open for business, if you can find the door. The new lounge is on Clark Street in Andersonville, and it prides itself not only on what's on stage at the parlor, but wowing crowds before they even step foot in the space. Magicians and parlors have always been a part of Chicago's history, but usually they come in the form of magic nights or booking magicians at restaurants and clubs. Rarely, if at all, has there ever been a theater dedicated to the dark arts. Bar, sure, plenty, but no magic theater. Joey Cranford looks to change that. He's a co-owner of the space. Joey's been a longtime member of the Chicago improv and theater community as an actor, comedian. He's also been one of Chicago's premier concierge at some of the downtown hotels, a longtime tour guide in town, and he's in studio now. Joey Cranford. Good to see you, Joey. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, good to see you too, man.
This is great, man. I'm proud of you, and I'm very happy for the success of the space. I know GN was just in there for Radio Recess, and you're getting a ton of press, so congratulations on this. What is the impetus to have a magic theater?
Oh, man. There's just so... There's just so few places to see magic at any given time. But it wasn't a master plan. This thing happened organically through just a little bit of curiosity by me into what goes into putting on a magic show. I was on the radio. Actually, it was on WGN radio about three years ago upstairs. And we were 2 days after our first opening whenever we ran the show at the Uptown Underground.
Yeah.
And she said, it was Bosworth. She said, what's the goal here? And I said, we're going to open our own place. How long have you been open? 2 days. I had no clue. I just had this vision that it could happen again.
That's amazing, too, because for anyone who's anywhere near the arts to be in a position where you can get your own space.
Yeah.
Build out the whole bit in the city of Chicago. That is an undertaking. We'll talk about that. That's crazy. Magic and a little bit of history here. Yeah. I mean, as you mentioned to me right before we started, the bar that had magic bars were invented in Chicago. Chicago does have this connection to magic.
Right. There's it goes back to around I mean, if you want to go back, we have the time. 1893 Columbian Exposition.
Yeah.
There was Houdini playing as the Brothers Houdini. It was him and one of his friends. It wasn't his brother yet that joined the act. And they were in the midway doing a fakir act. I can say that word on the radio if I say it slowly. Fakir act.
Fakir.
And they were also doing close-up magic there. And so, you know, Chicago audiences got a taste of it at the turn of the century, seeing magic done up close and personal. But this era was about the big stuff, you know, the levitations and the sawing people in half and all that, smoke and mirrors and trapdoors and all that.
Yeah.
But Harry Blackstone, who was from Chicago, big name in the city, he ended up, the story goes that he went to Schulian's, a little German restaurant, and performed magic at a table while people were waiting for the food to come out, over drinks, having a good time, laughing. And that kind of was that moment of breaking the fourth wall for magic. And what didn't need a big stage, didn't need 2,000 people in the audience. It really just needed four people ready to laugh and have a good time.
And that's I saw that term really for the first time today, looking at your story about close-up magic.
Yeah.
This concept of really when we talk about card games and card tricks, that's in the arts of close-up magic. Yeah.
Close-up magic has been around forever. We didn't invent that. We just invented doing it at bars. So the magic that happens up close, personal, everyday objects, cards, coins, small apparatus, ropes, you know, small things that can be done. That was done in an informal setting in Chicago, and that's kind of what we've done towards the arts. So we approached this like blue collar lifestyle by bringing it into the bars. And so you didn't have to, you know, Chicago's never been one of those places that like puts on the coat and goes out. We had an opera, but nobody wanted to see it, you know, like in the early days.
Right.
The very first cultural arts was the symphony. And at that time, no one wanted to see Thomas's orchestra. They were like locking them in, playing Yankee Doodle Dandy and stuff. And it's like he could conduct, he came from the Philharmonic and he's doing, you know, the pops, turn of the century. And so, you know, for Chicago, it was 1915. Matt Schulian, the son of the owner, he had been working on some card tricks and he was like, Dad, this is cool. I'm going to do this. And so he's like, okay. But then that just churned out all of these new magicians. There was a hotel downtown called the LaSalle Hotel, long gone. There was a place inside it called the Gay 90s. Apparently, that was the term for the 1890s, the Gay 90s. And there was a magician in there. And he ended up, his name was Johnny Paul. And he ended up being the first one to perform behind the bar, really calling it a bar magician, turning the bar into a stage.
Wow.
And so Schulian was known for table magic, and Johnny Paul was known for bar magic. And then in 1936, a place called Jim Ryan's Magic Tap opened up, and that was the first magic bar to be a truly dedicated magic bar. It was in the 30s. And so that was out on the west side near Austin community, so Division in Austin, basically. And then, like, rapidly, things just started happening. They were one by one. And then the 70s and 80s, there was about 9 open at one time. A little bit of magic on the south side of Chicago would go through 3 different iterations. There was the New York Lounge, which would move twice, open for 40 years. Drunk magic until 4 a.m. It was incredible. On north side, 5151 North Lincoln.
Wow.
There was Mr. C's Magic Lounge in Berwyn. Schulian's still going at the same time. They had the Magic Touch out in Palatine.
So what happened? I mean,
who knows?
Would they just stop doing this? I mean, when it's not. We're talking kind of contemporary times.
Yeah, yeah.
80s,
well,
right?
I mean, up into the 80s, there was. I mean, you still had a place called Houdini's Pub and Pizza Magic. But times were changing. You know, I mean, you mentioned I come from the comedy world. I was a stand up in Austin for a brief time before moving into the improv world, and that whole scene began around the decline of these bars. So whether it was changing tastes in what audiences were going towards, I mean, that's basically what killed the disco scene, was changing tastes. But I tried to find it, because I'm kind of a history nerd. I like to dig in and figure it all out.
And I love it.
and there is no cause to it. New York Lounge closed because their owner Jack Murray didn't want to do it anymore, and nobody wanted to take the reins.
Wow.
These were magicians, not businessmen. Schulian's closed because the patriarch Charlie, he passed away, and the family was kind of like, we've done it since the 1880s, we're good.
You and me both doing comedy stuff, there was always a hierarchy or at least a a career trajectory, right? Yep. You would get to a point where you're like, okay, I do improv for a certain point, and then I'm going to get on Saturday Night Live, and then I'm going to be a star. Is it the same in the magic world where, like, you know, the 80s and 90s were like, I'm a young magician. If I can get to Vegas.
If I can just get on this bar, you know, then someone will see me, and then they'll forget they saw me because they were hammered. Forget what I even did. What I think he got my car. It's all very hazy. No, it was a completely different hierarchy. But it's funny that you mention kind of the parallels of improv and magic, because, you know, coming from a background in theater and the community of improv, I walked into the magic community not knowing anything about it. Turns out very solitary art. You get better by practicing alone. In your bedroom in front of a mirror, you know. There's only a few places that you can talk about the secrets of magic, and that's generally at a magic shop or at clubs that are formed around the city. And we've got loads of old clubs. Houdini formed a club in 1919 in Chicago, Society of American Magicians. It's a real thing. And but there's no formal community. And so that was the other thing that I was really interested in, because, you know, when you meet about four magicians at a time, it's kind of weird. I went to a party one time at Magic Incorporated, at Magic Inc. My wife actually got me into this party, and there was about 20 magicians in the room, and it was amazing. They knew I was new to it, and so I was the sucker. Like, I was the one layman that they could just tear apart, and I had so much fun. And I was like, why doesn't this happen all the time? You know, when I was on the road, we'd go back to Improv Olympic at the time, you know, and we would, you know, you'd go to the bar and you'd see what was happening and see what's, you know, hip and fresh.
All improvisers and everywhere.
Yep. Know? And then if you're a stand-up, you hang out at the back of the club and you watch and you see who's up and coming, who's working on the material. And then that kind of chat between the two artists at the end of the night over a couple of drinks, the community just kind of supports you get better with everybody. But the magic community
didn't have that.
They didn't have that. So I wanted to kind of, using an improv term, map it over the magic community and see if I could create a roof and a haven.
Well, you've done
these magicians.
The Chicago Magic Lounge up in Andersonville, 5050 North Clark. Joey Cranford in studio is a co-owner. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. Let's talk about how you got it done. I mean, again, because you're a great storyteller, and of course your interest in telling it the right way, you were able to capture the story on a blog of building the theater.
Yeah.
So we'll talk more with Joey Cranford, my guest in the download. Stay with us. It's Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me tonight, Joey Cranford, talking about his new theater, the Chicago Magic Lounge. I guess it's a magic lounge. It's not a theater. I keep calling it a theater, but that's, I get old habits die hard. I know Joey from the theater, from doing improv and comedy in Chicago. Let's talk about this. You know, I always think about, you know, how hard it is to put a theater together. And to do one that's magic as well. I mean, that's hard. It's hard to get brick and mortar in this town.
Yeah.
There's a lot of itinerant theater companies, and the reason they are is because it costs money, and it's hard to be on the hook for a space. Talk about why you chose this route. Why not just stay at the Uptown Underground or other places and do shows? What was it about starting your own spot?
I think the vision of this show was larger than we kind of planned for in the beginning. It was, we had so much momentum. We'd gotten so much attention from this community of artists that this was something they needed as well. The why of our product was so strong. It's written by Simon Sinek. People don't buy what you do. They buy why you do it. Right. And we told the story every night in front of this audience, and they just fell in love with the concept, with the vision. This wasn't just a magic show. This was a revolution. You know, it's kind of how I emceed the whole night, and it just captured everyone's imagination. It wrapped them into this like history that they didn't know about. And any Chicagoan loves the history of this city. And if there's something if there's a little uncovered piece that they are like, wait a minute, I didn't know that. And I've read Devil in the White City. You know what I mean? So we captured their imaginations that way. But and because of the passion and the vision and our dedication to just doing it to the best of our ability, every night we grew from one night to two nights. And then we captured the attention of my partner, Donald C. Clark Jr. He came to see a show and was immediately taken away by just the raw passion that he felt. And he said, would you like to talk about something else? what's next. So we got to working on it, and we tried a little things here and there to kind of tweak it and to see, like, little tests, really, to see if the market could bear a little bit more. And we started bringing in acts from out of town, and then we said, all right, let's, the conversation was, we dropped a pebble, now let's drop a rock in the pond and see what happens.
See what happens.
We were approached by many people, though. He wasn't the only one that wanted to partner, but Don immediately got the vision, and we became friends through this. So and great. He's not, you know, a lot of people think that, oh, okay, you're gonna have this thing, and you've got a shadow behind you that's going to front the whole thing, and they're just waiting for their returns. But Don was more of a passionate visionary in this project as well. So he was able to just provide all of his creative input as well. And he's also producing shows in New York and Broadway. He produced The Encounter, which got a special Tony for sound, and he's got a film that he's working on now. So he's lived an amazing life as an attorney, and now it's time for him to become a child again.
Well, okay, so let me ask you this. You know, is this a dream come true for you? I mean, were you a kid who at 5 years old, 6 years old, was pulling quarters out of ears and figuring that, you know, like, I mean, is
now,
this...
I've been an actor since I was, like, in kindergarten, you know? I was the ringleader in some circus thing, I vaguely remember. But I've always been in the theater, and I always kind of... you know, in the back of your mind, like, it'd be great to actually own a theater, but, you know, my Beckett and Pinter plays would only get me so far in the world,
right,
you know?
Right.
It's always been a dream to just be an artist, dive into that world of art, but no, magic was never. I went to prank shops when I was 10 years old.
Sure.
I was like the kid with a dollar snatcher and the fake
throw-up.
Well,
where does magic come from? I mean, what was the draw?
You want to know? It started as a bit.
As
a joke.
Of course it did.
And this is just how far I'll take a joke, you know? No, it... my wife and I, we used to. Now this is, you know, nothing against the magician, because he's reputable among some. But if you would go to Walgreens, or if you went to Walgreens about, you know, 5 years ago, you would see the Criss Angel magic set, and it had you know, the Criss Angel Mind Freak deck, you know, and it was all of these effects that you could get for $29.95. But if you saw on the side of it, it said a $250 value. So we were just immediately like, this is great. This is valuable. We should buy 10 of these, sell it for parts out of the back of our trunk, like R. Kelly did at Rock and Roll McDonald's with the CDs, right? We'll make a mint. We'll retire by selling off these magic, because they're just giving these away. So every time we'd go to Walgreens, like, we need toilet paper. Should we get our retirement while we're here as well? You know, so what we need a toothpaste. We're gonna get we need some creamer, and then also do we need the magic sets tonight? I don't. We'll just walk away from our future. And so it just was this running bit, and it just kind of went away for a while. And then my wife, Cindy, she there's a weird box under the tree for Christmas, and I was shaking it, and I had no idea what it was. And I cried when I opened that, and it was the Crystal Magic set. It was the funniest thing I'd ever seen. It was amazing.
Yeah.
And so I opened it, and it was amazing. Like, the Criss Angel Mind Freak deck was great. And so I learned a magic trick and showed our friends at Poker Night. And they were like, do another one. I was like, I can't.
I can't.
That's the only one.
Give me a week.
So, yeah. So it led me to magic shop. Cindy found the better magic shop, which led to this big magic part. And it just happened. It just magically appeared into my life.
I love it. Joey Cranford is the co-owner of the Chicago Magic Lounge, which is now open for business, 5050 North Clark Street in Andersonville, the first magic theater that we know of. There are many, many magic bars, but magic theaters. You got to come back, Joey. We got to do more and talk about what you're doing up there and beginning a new history for Chicago. Yep. So thanks for being here, man. Good
Thank
to see you.
You. Thanks for having me.
It's time for Swap Meet. Oh, yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure, like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Oh, it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman.
And Greg Flam.
Here we are.
That's right. Good to see you, Greg.
It's good to be back.
It's a download here on 720 WGN, and it's time for the Swap Meets. This, of course, our weekly segment we usually do on Thursdays. Moving back to Wednesday to to much fanfare.
Yes.
Last Wednesday, the people, Marty came out, everybody came out.
Well, and it's the pizza. Yeah.
It's the pizza. The extra added wrinkle to the program, of course, this program we've been doing for a couple years now, where we will evaluate your collectibles, your memorabilia, your junk, 312-981-7200. But the extra wrinkle is if you got something to brag about, and it's a good brag, a good Chicago brag. I'm the judge.
Yes, you are.
Yeah, I get to be the one who if it's the best Chicago brag, I'm going to give you Lou Malnati's pizza. That's what we're going to do. 312-981-7200. Even if you know what it's worth, or maybe it's you know that it's not necessarily something that needs to be evaluated, you just want to brag that you have it.
Right.
This is the time to do it. Also, we have an extra guest in studio, yes. A special guest. Very excited to welcome Joy Williams. She is she is Jeans with Joy, both on Facebook and Twitter, and she is in the world of denim, and I love it. Joy Williams, welcome to the download. Welcome to the swap meet.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Okay, so I have so many questions about denim and denim. You have some selections in studio here, but this is really an area that I know not much about, but this is a lucrative and an area when it comes to resell brands and jeans and denim that a lot of people don't think about, that it has a huge following. Talk about it.
It does. So there's the vintage portion of it, your vintage Levi's. Vintage Levi's can sell for thousands and thousands of dollars.
What?
Tens of thousands of dollars. Levi's themselves bought a couple of times jeans from people who either unearthed them or put them up for auction on eBay. The old record, which was broken about a year or so ago, was they paid $46,000 on an eBay auction for a pair of jeans that were pulled out of a mine in Nevada.
Wow.
But there's also what they call Big E Levi's, which was prior to 1971, the little Levi's tag that you see had all capital letters. Okay, so prior to 1971, when you see the Big E on there, those sell every day on eBay as they come up for thousands of dollars. So that's like a holy grail denim picker kind of thing that you look for. But you're not going to find them all the time. Like, I can't, you know.
You can't find them.
I can't earn a living just selling.
So I was going to say, my fifth or sixth pair of jeans that have gone completely colorless with a rip in the, those aren't worth anything?
Sometimes they are, actually.
If you I have plenty.
You got hope.
Look at used jeans and Levi's, there is a whole fashion, you know, movement where people want distressed, they want trashed or thrashed, and they want it as ugly and dirty and beat up and patched as they can possibly get
really?
It. And they will pay hundreds of dollars for the right style. And even the ones you would see from the 70s, like, I don't know if you had sisters, but how we would sew patches of rainbows and clouds and suns, they love that stuff. Bell bottoms. Everything that's sort of old comes around again. And there is a huge movement of people who dress in vintage clothes every day, whether it's jeans or dresses or whatever. So vintage clothing as a whole is really popular on eBay.
Wow. Do you come across that stuff at estate sales and stuff, Greg?
I do, but I don't have enough knowledge to pull the trigger on it when I see it. And that's why I kind of follow Joy a little bit.
I just have this great image in my head of Greg holding up jeans at an estate sale, being like, I don't know, do I like them?
It's like that or like a vintage game. Okay, vintage game. Yeah.
I'll take vintage. All right, Joy, you've got a couple of selections you brought in here. What do you got here?
I do. So this is actually something that I picked today, in fact, which is vintage Levi's is my thing. Like, that's where my heart and soul is. And this is a vintage Levi's denim vest with a Sherpa lining and the orange tab, which the orange tab is
That's what you want to get,
70s, right? And in fact, it's so popular, and it has been so good to us as resellers that last year Levi's, their little light bulb finally went on, and they said, hey, let's get in on the action, and they re-released some of it, but only for a season.
It's got a very Farrah Fawcett, Heather Locklear kind of look to it, right? That's what you would wear if you were in The Fall Guy with Lee Majors.
Exactly. Right? I was going to say the Smokey and the Bandit kind of thing.
Yeah, that's, right on. There we go.
That's what that is. And
okay.
There's a lot of guys who love that.
What is that? What does that kind of thing go for?
I actually bought this today, in fact, at Salvation Army store, which I love Salvation Army stores, for $4.99. And I'll probably get $60 to $80 for this vest.
Wow.
And it weighs nothing, so it's quick and easy to ship, and I like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, what else you got here?
The other movement is, the 80s and 90s, the Tommy
Jeans.
Hilfiger, right, is very popular. But the big Tommy Hilfiger, they call this a flag patch on the back. The bigger it says Tommy Hilfiger, the more they pay for it. The denim jacket that has the big flag all across the back sells all the time over $300.
Yes.
If you went to junior high or high school in the 80s or 90s, you probably have one in your closet.
Right.
Put it on eBay. So I love Tommy jeans. The overalls sell all the time for over $100. And what's even better is international buyers love it. In Sweden and Switzerland, I sell a lot of Tommy Hilfiger to other countries.
I am blown away by this.
I heard Japan is a huge market for Levi's.
Japan loves American-made denim, mm-hmm. and they love Levi's in particular. Mm-hmm. In Japan, there are people who literally have collections of vintage Levi's that are worth hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yep.
And they will pay $12,000 for a pair of vintage Levi's on eBay all day long.
Are we still liking Cavaricci's? Is that still a thing?
You know, Z Cavaricci, vintage mm-hmm. Z Cavaricci, and some of the guests. They like
that. Oh,
yeah,
guests,
triangle,
right. Yeah.
Right? It's one of two things. What's old, it, you know, comes around again style-wise, or people are reliving their youth. And that's the thing about selling denim is what we're doing and the reason people are spending so much money is it's an emotional purchase. People remember the 90s,
yes.
They had this jeans on, and they were so cool, yep. And they're like, oh, I want those, and I'm willing to pay right. crazy money
oh,
for
man.
It.
Oh, man, you know what I should have had in my life? I should have had, like, a really tight pair of white, like, full white jeans, you know, like White Lion or, like, a Europe,
yeah.
You know, like something yeah. like that, like a Cinderella. Mm-hmm. And I never got there. I just couldn't pull the trigger. Now I'd be worth hundreds of dollars.
That's true.
Probably more.
I messed
yeah,
it up.
More.
I messed up my life.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, it's file it under those posters and toys that, you know, didn't make it.
All right, 312-981-7200. Greg, what do you got? We didn't even talk about what you brought.
I brought Joy. Joy's my show and Joy. I figured we'd devote that.
It's good. So you teach denim reselling. What do you got coming? You got an event coming up.
So I do have an event coming up. I teach thrifting classes about buying and reselling denim. Buying it super cheap, selling it, not just for the stuff that sells for crazy money, but what I like to call bread and butter denim, which is stuff that's going to sell all the time, $25, $35, $55. You know, it's great to find something that sells for $100, but it doesn't happen every day. But if you know what you're looking for, you can walk into any estate sale or garage sale or your closet or thrift
Goodwill,
store
right.
and pull stuff out that's going to sell on a regular basis.
Wow. Oh, I love it.
Yep. All right.
So we actually go to the thrift store and I teach you how to do it.
Okay. It's at Jeans with Joy, which is both on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all that kind of stuff. So you can get the information on what's coming up, classes, workshops. Greg Flam in studio as well at DuPage
yes.
Picker. 312-981-7200. We also got people on the line. People texting in, so we're gonna have a good swap meet
yep,
tonight. So stay with us. Hey, it's a download 720 WGN, and it's time for the swap meet. 312-981-7200. Greg Flam at DuPage Picker in studio. You can find them both on Facebook and Twitter. And Joy Williams joins us, special guest. She is Jeans with Joy on Facebook and Twitter. Denim Picker, is that the right
yeah.
way to say that? Come look at me. Joy's 859 says, Joy's knowledge of denim is incredible. I attended her class in October. I was astounded what I had previously overlooked. So if you right now are listening going, I got jeans from the, I know Pete Zimmerman's got jeans from the 70s. That's classic. Now's the time to go deep into the closet, pull them out, and tell us what you got.
What's great is that normally we ask people to go to the attic or the basement.
This is
and
easy.
Now they just got to walk, like, stay on the same level, go to their closet, or go to a drawer. You know.
What about Wranglers? Nobody cares about the Wranglers?
They do. They
love
the Wrangler. Bell bottoms are big money. Yeah, well over $100. Yeah. Go to your dad's closet. When you go home for Easter, like, just go in your parents' bedroom, start poking around, see what's
yep.
hiding in the back of dad's closet. Ask mom what she's been telling them to throw away for 30
right.
years. And then put that on eBay.
I love it. All right, let's start us off with John. John, what do you want to brag about, John?
Hi, yeah. A 1963 Super Bowl champion team autographed football from the Chicago Bears.
Yeah. Well, wow. Well, it'd be an NFL championship because the Super Bowl didn't happen until later. But
yeah.
But the one that was played at Wrigley Field for the Bears. Who do you got autographed? The whole team?
Yep.
Wow. Nice. I was going to ask how many autographs, and I recently one sold for $250, which you think it'd be more than that, and it quite possibly could be, but that's what one did sell for recently.
You got Dick on that one, right?
It.
Dick is on that.
Yeah.
Dick is on that. Johnny
yeah.
Morris is on that,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yep.
You're going to
yep.
have...
Sid Luckman?
You're going to have...
who was
yeah, quarterback? Yeah, you're going to have Luckman, but you're going to have... Ed, OB?
OB.
OB's going to be on there?
Yeah.
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 All right, cool, John. Thank you.
Sounds good. Thank
Thanks
you.
For calling.
Yeah, my dad parked cars for that game. He loves to tell that story.
Wrigley, yeah.
He told me that story in Jamaica. I'm like, I know the story. I know the story. He told me a million times. Let's go to Joe. Joe, what do you want to brag about, Joe?
Hey, listen, I thought I'd come out of the closet. I mean, the woodwork for your second.
How you doing?
Premiere on Wednesday night.
Always recognize the voice.
Amen. Listen, this doesn't. It's not a Chicago show. It goes back to my original point of origin, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, right?
Okay.
Yeah. And it's a clock. Jefferson Electric, made in Bellwood, Illinois. And it's titled The Golden Hour,
yep.
quote unquote.
I think Joy's got you here.
Yeah, Joy, got it.
The significance here is this is back in the area, late 40s, where Alcoa was, you know, enjoying a heyday due to World War II, building all the airplanes out of aluminum, whatever. And all the VPs got one of these clocks. It even reads on the bottom, patent pending.
Wow.
Wow. Okay, so Joy, what do we got on the Golden Hour clock out of Bellwood?
So the good news for you is that they are popular and they do sell. There's a wide price range where people have sold them anywhere from $30 to $70. On average, I would say about $60.
Really?
But because he had, it was a special edition one, that might be a little bit more.
As a special edition one, what I would do is that would be one that you'd want to do as an auction. Like whatever your minimum that you will take for that clock, that's where you start the bidding.
Yeah.
Comprende.
All right. Thanks,
okay,
Joe.
Thanks, Joe.
Thanks, everybody. Okay, 630 says, what's Joy, this is for you, Joy, what's Joy's biggest pet peeve about online denim sellers?
Oh, sellers who photograph their clothing on the floor. Unless you are selling a rug, do not put your textiles on the floor. Macy's, they're not photographing their clothes on the floor, and you shouldn't be either.
Where should they do it, Jean?
So go, if you don't have one, go to thrift store under a dollar. You can buy a white sheet. Like if that's the only place you have to photograph, put that white sheet down. At least I don't know that's your dirty kitchen floor, right? Just try to pretend that you have some, you know, some sensibility and don't put it on the floor.
All right, good. That's good. Good advice. All right, let's see. Here we go. 630 says, glad to have you back on Wednesday. I was cleaning out my junk drawers, found a complete set sealed in a wrapper of hologram baseball cards from 1992. Denny's used to sponsor them, but I have one complete set. Any idea of what the value would be? Again, I know this answer a little bit. Denny's might be make it a little different, but baseball cards are not what you think they are in full sets because everybody's got them.
Right, especially post 70s, you know, the prices went down.
Once the big sideburns and the big mustaches went away, then it was like, who cares?
Yeah, to give you an idea, a complete set, like $20, you know, $15-$20 for a complete set, you know, and that's unwrapped
more than
sometimes.
I thought it would be.
Yeah. But yeah, still cool.
708's got one here. I have a Thumbelina doll in excellent condition. Does it have any value other than great childhood memories? Thumbelina doll.
Take that?
So there's a lot of different Thumbelina dolls. I mean, it's
what is
hard
a Thumbel-
to say.
What
so
is the Thumbelina
is a Disney character.
Okay, got it.
And you know, it really depends on the doll. If we could see a picture of it or something like that. You know, there's a lot. Disney people are crazy. They'll give you their money all day long. They will line up.
Same thing
pre-80s. Yeah, exactly.
Like they'll give you
so
everything.
It could be a doll that's in. So the way that you identify is you put Thumbelina doll, as much as you know about the doll, into eBay, and then you sort, you refine your search by sold. And then you can sort of start to see the stuff that has sold. If you have a doll like that, then you want to keep digging into it.
Right.
If you see your doll has sold for $5 a whole bunch of times, then hold
you
on to your
get
memories.
Out. Yeah.
To
yeah. Hold on to your memories.
Yeah.
Right.
It sounds like one of those 80s songs that I'd wear a denim.
Yeah.
To celebrate. Hold on to the memories.
Right.
Okay. The DuPage Picker and you and I are going to write a song like
that. All right. Yeah, right. There you go.
All right, we'll keep going here. 773's got a 1936 Oneida? Silverware set with a Rogers 12-place flatware setting, Meadowbrook pattern, tested positive for silver, content by a cash for gold store.
Yeah.
Ding, ding, ding.
Yeah, we had this, I think, last week, one of the calls, yeah. And you know, that's it's hard to, you know, because of all those details with the different silver. So you got the silver content, of course.
Right.
But then the design and how complete the set is, how many pieces will determine. But you're probably looking at minimum 200, 300, you know, for that. Maybe quite a bit more.
630 wants to know, how many years does it have to be before you can call it, quote, vintage?
So vintage is 20 years or older, and an antique is 100 years or older. So when you think about vintage, we all probably think, oh, 50s, 60s, but really stuff we were wearing in the 80s and 90s is vintage.
So anything from 1998?
Yes.
Like vintage. I was in NSYNC? Mm-hmm. That's vintage at this
vintage,
point?
Yep. Vintage at this point.
Wow.
Yep.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing. I feel like now I've shifted my paradigm. I feel like now I'd be like, maybe I do have a lot of vintage stuff.
Right, and it's good to be able to know you can call that vintage because it seems like, okay, now bigger dollars.
Like Britney Spears would be vintage at this point.
She's very vintage at this point, yeah. I mean, Britney Spears, they're all, you know, they were early 90s and all their stuff could be considered vintage.
Wow.
Yep.
All right. Joy Williams is our special guest tonight on the Swap Meet. Jeans with Joy on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. She's a denim picker and she has classes on what to look for. You can find out all that information at her social media. Greg Flamm, of course, at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. We'll take a quick break. We'll get the news tonight and we'll come back for the second half of the Swap Meet. I'm giving away a pizza for the best story, and I don't think I've gotten it yet. 312-981-7200. Stay with us. And
it's time for Swap Meet. Oh, yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure, like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Oh, it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman.
And Greg Flamm.
Second half.
And Joy Williams. Keep going.
I know.
Pete Zimmerman.
Yep.
Pamela Jones.
All right. There we go.
Joy Williams is our special guest on the Swap Meet tonight at Jeans with Joy on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. She's a denim picker. We've been talking about denim tonight, but also she has been monster help in evaluating everybody's collectibles. And, of course, you know, this is a segment where you brag about what you got, and the best brag is going to get you a Lou Malnati's pizza. I haven't gotten it yet.
No, we haven't.
I mean, I like the 63 ball. I like the autograph, but at the same time, we get that a lot.
Last week, it was like one of the first calls.
Yeah. Well, it's Marty.
We knew, though.
Yeah. We knew right away. You could feel it. Yeah.
Yep.
Someone could have called in right now and said, I have a pair of ripped Cavaricis. You know, Stonewash, which I wore to see Bon Jovi at the Rosemont Horizon. I'm in!
Right.
Absolutely.
You're going to get yourself a pizza.
Bring us your denim.
Right.
What do you got?
All right, let's go to the phones. Let's go to Greg. Greg, you want us to kick us off? What you want to brag about?
Hey, how are you guys tonight?
Good. Thanks.
Man. So I was cleaning out my mom's basement, and my Boucher had a chest down there, and inside the chest was a box that had a stack of old Polish money, some of it dating before 1900.
Wow. Jeez Louise. Wow. What does that do? I mean, do you even find that? Like, what is that?
I didn't find a whole lot on eBay, but that's something that could be very specialized. I would look into finding someone who specializes in valuing
money,
currency. Yeah, because, you know, when you look at the eBay solds, that's the last 90 days. So what you have might be more valuable. I don't want to tell you that it's worthless. I just don't have anything to give you right now.
Yeah. Go find somebody who knows everything about
money. Coin dealer.
Yeah, coin dealer would be somebody to talk to.
There you go. All right, thanks, Greg.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
All right,
buddy. Let's go to Bill. Bill, what do you want to brag about, Bill?
Yeah, I got a couple of things. One thing I have about a 1942-43 Lionel Train, a big metal one with the boxcar, a cattle car, where you pull it up and the cattle actually vibrate into the car.
Okay.
And also, I have a, belonged to my wife. She got it, I don't know how many, it's probably over 100 years old. I don't know, maybe you know, a kid, they call it a kid doll. It's by kid, that's the skin it's made out of, and it's jointed, but it's put together with nuts and bolts, and has a China face, a painted China face, and real hair.
You just scared me. I don't know what you're talking about, but these guys seem to nod their head. They know what's happening. But
I'm nodding to the Lionel part, the Dow part. I'll see if Joy knows that. But the cattle car, I mean, some of those have sold for $1,500, some $300.
There
so
you go.
Obviously, the better condition in the box, you know.
Yeah, just the whole train set.
Yeah, then obviously you're much higher. You're probably more like in the 3,000 range if it's the whole set, is what I'm thinking. But yeah, that's cool that you have it, and we'll see what Joy can find.
It's not an original box, but it's in a box.
Okay,
it's in a box.
So yeah, maybe you know 2,000 range then without the box. But let's see what we can find here on your dolls.
Yeah, kids dolls.
Yeah, it's a kid doll. The material is called kid. Okay. It's like a leather, and it's sort of a white leather, and it's jointed, but the joints are put together with bolts, nuts and bolts.
Right. Yeah, and it's hard because when you punch in kid doll, it's like a million things come up. So
actually, it's called, the way you look them up, they're called kid bodies.
Okay.
So they're sort of, you know, 100 years ago, you know, you didn't go buy Barbie off the shelf,
right?
So it would be a body that was made out of fabric. That was less expensive, and then we put a China head on it.
Okay.
So some of the, you know, the older they are, sometimes the more that they're worth, but you have to be careful about condition. The better the condition a vintage doll is, the more it's going to be worth.
This is mint condition. It's a mint condition that's been wrapped and sealed away for years. I mean,
Here's what I would do. If I were you, Bill, I would take it out. I'd get it unwrapped. I'd play with it for a couple hours, see what it can do, and then put it back, and then you're fine to go, right? Would that be the advice you guys would give?
That's the kind of thing that, you know, if you have people to hand it down to, that you know, those dolls, the longer we go on in time, the less likely someone's ever going to have one in mint. And so, you know, if you have grandkids, it's one of those things that, you know, grandma used to play with this doll. 100 years from now, the Cabbage Patch isn't going to have that same sense of awe that Grandma used to play with this as a kid body doll.
312-981-7200 is the phone number. Man, the lines are lighting up. Let's 815 says I have two pair of Big Bell Levi's from the '70s.
Ooh,
like, that's a thing.
That is money. I mean, it's just money, and the condition doesn't always matter because there's a lot of there's a lot of people who go to festivals like Coachella, like the dirtier, the grungier, the, you know, kind of boho look. It's very in. So don't discount them based on condition. But, you know, a good pair of 70s Levi's can fetch $100 or more.
Wow. That's out of my price range.
But
when I go to Levi's, when I go to Kohl's, I'm looking for a 30 to 35.
Right, buy one, get one free.
Yeah, buy one 50% off.
Yeah, 50% off.
You want to check the little tab on the back pocket. The capital E increases that value a lot.
Something tells me this one does not have a capital E. I'm just going to say that I'm wearing right now. 253 says, I see a lot of Levi's when I'm out thrifting, but they all seem to be priced so high. What's an average price you like to pay for Levi's?
So one of the things that I teach people in my classes is you have to get to know your discount days. All the major thrift stores have discount days. You make your money when you buy stuff. You know, I can sell a pair of jeans for $100, but if I paid $25 for them instead of $5 for them, if I'm not going on a discount day, I like to stay around $6, but I buy a lot of jeans under a dollar.
Wow.
And when you're starting out, when the cheaper you buy them, it's okay to make mistakes.
Jason, what do you want to brag about, Jason?
Does Joy really know what she's talking about?
We know who this is, and this is the infamous Jason T. Smith from the Thrift Hunter Show, Spike TV, and it's an honor to have you on our airwaves, sir.
That's great. I guess
thanks for calling in. What do you want to say about Joy? What can we learn here?
Joy is the real deal. She teaches everybody about denim and Levi's, and she really knows her stuff, so I'm super excited to hear her on your radio show tonight. It's been awesome.
That's awesome. And it's awesome you called in. Thank you.
So Jason.
Yep, he's the master, and everyone should check out his Facebook group. 34,000 plus people on it, so he can't be wrong with his advice. And
I
became a big fan when he was on Spike TV, and he was there when I started eBaying. And just what I liked about his show versus the other ones is that when he found something, he put the price and the listing on his Facebook page so you could follow up weeks later and you could see, okay, this actually sold for this amount.
Yep.
None of this inflated pricing or whatever. Yeah.
Nice.
Exactly.
So,
that's the way I would do it.
High praise.
So I have nothing but high praise for him.
All right. Well, Jason, we're going to get when you can. I'm assuming you're not in Chicago just by your phone number, but when you get here, you got to come.
I live in Vegas, but I'm in Kansas City. I'm teaching some classes too.
There you go. All right.
Yep.
Well, thanks
keep
for
kicking ass, Joy.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yep. Thanks for calling, Jason.
All right. Bye-bye. That's awesome. Look at this. We got celebrities calling. Yep. This is what happened here, Greg.
Right. That's actually how I got my start. I was selling nude stuff on eBay, and my friend said, there's this guy on Spike TV, and you should join his Facebook group, the Thrifting Board. And so I did, and somebody put up a picture of these Biggie Levi's and said, does anybody know anything? And I just started Googling, and I got just fell down the rabbit hole, and I just fell in love. So that's how it all started.
All right, let's keep going here. Let's see. Let's go to, I'm assuming this is their first name, Squat. Squat, what do you want to brag about?
That's me. Hey, speaking of the news of the day, I have a vintage New Year's Stephen Gary VHS.
What?
Oh, wow.
What?
A moment of silence for the loop, please.
Yeah, a moment of silence for loops. Squat, that might actually be the winner tonight. Where'd you get it?
I wasn't going to call in, Justin, but I listen nightly, but when Wednesday comes around, I just listen to see what's up, and I thought of the pizza you're giving out now, man. I had to go for the New Year's Steve and Gary's got to be worth a pizza.
It's got to be at least worth a pizza, right?
Yeah.
I mean, does that kind of stuff show up on eBay?
Yeah, and oddly enough, yesterday when the news, I woke up to two items from the loop that sold yesterday morning, and I'm thinking that's kind of odd, two items, and then later on in the afternoon, my brother texted me, hey, the loop was sold. And I'm like, okay, that explains why I sold some loop items. So, yeah, it's probably, it's going to peak probably in the next few days or so. So if you are going to sell it, get it online. Otherwise, hold on to it.
Yeah, don't sell it. You know. Instead, right now, Squat's in the lead for a pizza.
Yep.
There's still 10 minutes to go, Squat, so we'll see. But
yep.
That's a big one.
I'm not selling it, though.
No, yeah, I probably wouldn't either.
You better start sending out the Evites for the party to watch that. That's
yeah, when you got a drunk Andy Cotton walk around his house, and you got to see that.
There you go. That's right. Nice. Thanks.
Thanks
again, man. Thanks for calling
good
in.
Luck.
312-981-7200. Oh, man, we got such good stuff. This is a flood of stuff. I've got the lines are jammed. Yeah. I've got texts out the wazoo, so we'll probably not get to everybody tonight because we've only got about 10 more minutes. But we'll take this last break. We'll come back, and we'll do rapid fire. Sound good?
Sounds awesome.
All right, stay with us. All right, it's the final leg here of the Swap Meet, 312-981-7200. Squat's in the lead for that pizza with that VHS of Stephen Gary's New Year's special. Joy Williams is here with Greg Flamm. Greg, of course, at DuPage Picker, joins us every single Wednesday. It used to be Thursday. Now we change it to Wednesday. We'll go back to Thursday at some point. Also in studio, our special guest, Joy Williams. Joy is a denim picker, and she is Jeans with Joy on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Friendster, wherever you want to find Jeans with Joy, she's going to be
Napster.
There. Napster.
Yeah. MySpace.
Yeah. On the line, let's go back to the phones. Laura, what do you want to brag about, Laura?
I've got a 1988 Bears calendar with Walter Payton and Jim McMahon's signature.
Wow.
Oh, with their signature.
Yeah, Payton's signatures do really well, so that's a good start there. And I'm going to say probably in the $75 to start range and just do an auction because you never know.
Is it just Payton and McMahon action shots throughout the calendar, or are they like dressed up in cool outfits?
No, it's all the Bears from the 86 Super Bowl Bears calendar.
I like when they get themed, the Miami Vice kind of thing or something like that. I'm not a big fan of their action shots. All right. Thanks, Laura.
Thanks for calling.
We've got a denim question, 773. Apparel Sassoon jeans from the 80s. What are those worth?
So I'm trying to find a good example.
Apparel Sassoon.
So Sassoon, people like Taylor Swift have helped us. Vintage men's jeans have always done well, but nobody wanted mom jeans. They got mocked. And then Taylor Swift started wearing them, and the celebrities started wearing them. And now the market has skyrocketed. For mom jeans.
Really?
Well, they call them high-waisted mom jeans. And in fact, I just sold a pair Last week that I bought for $2 and I took a best offer of $75 2 days after I listed them. I could have held out for probably twice that.
Come on.
So the more mom jean looking they are right now, and the high waisted just means that, like, the longer that they are, like from the button, like, yeah, you know, the whole zipper area, the higher that is, the higher
the more money it is. Are there times when you're like, come on, what am I, what's going on with this world that I live, that I work in? And that you're like, why would anybody want this? But they all want it.
They all want it. Yeah. Like,
is there times where you're just like head scratching? Like, you're just like, I can't believe people want this garbage.
No, because I love it. Like, I love the history of it. I love it. Like, you know, when I find things that have been laying around for 30 years and nobody's worn them and they have the tags on them. But that's the thing about clothing, is the styles all come around.
They all come back.
6 months from now, all we might all have big hair again. We don't know.
I'm hoping.
Yeah. So if they're very mom jean looking or very stonewashed, they love
very stonewashed,
the acid wash type look. Oh, they love that.
Wow. Wish I would have kept all my eighth grade jeans.
Yep,
time I would have killed it. I'd be making so much loot right now.
You only have to do the show 4 nights a week.
I know. My wife told me that she can't go to a store any longer and get a regular pair of jeans that doesn't have rips in them. Like, it's like, yeah, everywhere you go, it's all rips. Everything's rips in distressed the jeans and sold.
Distressed is very popular. Very popular. And what's great for us as resellers is the manufacturers are trying to push more and more seasons. Excuse me. Into every year. So by the time you go to the store and you buy a pair of jeans and you wear them a few times and you realize you love them, they're out of season, they're out of the store. You have to go to the secondary market now to buy more of them.
Really?
That's why you want to learn that second how to pair. Sell jeans.
Okay, so let's keep going here. 773 says they've got a double album Bob Dylan. And it doesn't say which one, so I'm assuming that he's only done one. We can move past that.
Okay.
Let's go to Kay. Kay, what do you want to brag about, Kay?
Hi, how are you?
Hi, good. How about you?
Okay, I bought these lasers on the farm auction. They look like a children's dish set. It's a cup and a saucer and a little tray. And on the side of the cup is a drawing of a lamb.
Oh, man, that's a bad connection. I'm sorry, Kay. It was a lamb dish. That's all I got. Right. I'm sorry, guys.
Sorry. You could email us or Facebook,
yeah,
and
sorry.
We'll get back to you on
Sorry about that. All right, and we've got so many things here, you guys. Mm-hmm. I feel terrible. There's like 35 texts. I can't get to them. We recently sold two Raggedy Ann Andy dolls that were 6.5 foot tall for a combined total of $800.
You want to take that, Joey? I think you know that person.
I do know that person. She's in our Facebook group, and she had these Raggedy Ann and Andy dolls, and they were like 6.5 feet tall. They were huge, and I think together she sold them for over $650. And she actually sold them separately. One person bought Raggedy Ann, and the other one bought Raggedy Andy.
Wow! All right, our final call for the night. Let's go to Christine. Christine, what do you want to brag about?
I have a 1975 Lori toddler doll in a red velvet dress in her original packaging. I got her for Christmas.
Wow, okay.
So let me just tell you, Lori toddler dolls. I actually just bought one myself for my twin sister for Christmas because we had gotten them in 1975 and the dog actually ate hers. And
that would be I.
Oh, hi. That is hysterical.
Is that family call? Now?
Yeah, that's what she said. I bought her a vintage doll.
Well, she's disqualified from the pizza, sorry.
Yeah.
She's disqualified. That's great.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling, Christine. That was the best.
Thank you.
Great way to end the segment.
Nice.
That was so good. So thank you so much. That was fun. That's your sister calling up. All right. Well, there you go. That's another episode of the Swap Meet. We're giving away the Lou Malnati's gift certificate. It's the home of Chicago's best deep dish pizza. Find one of their 40 plus Chicagoland locations or order online at loumalnati's.com. It's got to be the loop. It's got to be the Stephen Gary VHS that gets it. Squat, you got a free pizza for that. That's
awesome.
What it's worth.
Good job.
Greg Flam at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. And our guest tonight, Joy Williams. You got to come back. So fun to
I'd
have you.
I'd love to. Thanks for having
me. At Jeans with Joy, both on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all the places. And you can find out more about her classes, her workshops on reselling denim. She is one of the world's best to denim pickers, at least that I know. So, Joy, thanks for being here.
A lot of fun.
It.
Thanks for having me.